The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
All right, a very good morning to you. Welcome along this Monday morning to OTB AM. We're here with you until 9:30. We're here every day of the week, and we can be a radio show, we can be a TV show, we can be whatever you want. You can get us on youtube.com/offtheball, or you can get us on the Go Loud app or offtheball.com/radio. Dan McDonald's here with us this morning. Dan, how are you?
Morning, Jar. I'm good.
What's going on?
Not much.
The league is over, we can relax now and we need to watch the top of the table.
Yeah.
Whether or not Man City qualify for the Champions League next season is the only bit of jeopardy that's left, right?
Declared over, yeah. I mean, I know Johnny Ward sometimes sits here. He got a lot of stick for like declaring the League of Ireland title race over earlier in April this year. And I saw someone pointing out last night that I think Mourinho's confidence was Johnny-esque, you know, in terms of like saying, this is it, this is done. It's not done.
Do you not think it's done?
No.
Really?
I don't think so. No, not when they still have to play them once, and then it's, you know, you're two results away from sort of making things interesting. So it doesn't. I mean, I do think Liverpool will win the league now. I never felt that really at any point last season, because City were, in some ways you have to lose one to win one to a degree, and like Liverpool like had their time in front last year, whereas they seem to have sort of learned from it, or they just seem to be that Villa game, for example, like that ability to win. You think, okay, well then they should be okay. The flip side is they were still one down away to Villa after 85 minutes. You know what I mean? So they're not sort of like
Villa though.
You know they did, but they've had a lot of late goals, which is a credit to like their amazing sort of. It's not just like spirit. Spirit just makes it sound like they're sort of grinding it. It's ability. It's ability merged with sort of spirit.
Resilience, but, conditioning.
Yeah, exactly. And but they still, there have been times in games where they've been in a bit of bother. You know, so and they do have the World Club Cup coming up in December as well, and that will ask things of them. So it's completely plausible that they will drop sort of 3 to 6 points, in that window. Like they play City again, so it's not done. But you think that as front runners this time they'd be much more comfortable than they were last time.
It is done though, really, at this stage.
You just want your soundbite.
Well,
it's over.
No, it feels over because Leicester City aren't going to win the league this year. It doesn't feel like Leicester City are as good as. Maybe, look, I think actually of the teams who are left, Leicester and Chelsea might be able to put up more of a battle over the rest of the season than the City team do at the minute, because they seem like a rabble. Their defence is absolutely shot.
Yeah, I know.
It almost feels like we're reaching that point in the cycle where Guardiola starts to annoy the team so much that they're like, okay, I'm a very seasoned international footballer with loads and loads of money. I don't actually need to listen to your crap anymore. You were supposed to win us the Champions League. Where's our Champions League, Pep?
Maybe they're just going to win the Champions League now instead.
Maybe.
That becomes the focus. But
this defence doesn't fill you full of...
No, and you don't trust... I think it's the problem more so than anything like debating Liverpool's sort of strengths or whatever and weaknesses. It's more so, well, in every scenario, probably Man City need to go on a winning run of sort of, a 14-15 match almost perfect sequence. Like,
yeah.
You think that would be necessary, and can you necessarily trust them to do that? Then no. Like, there were still passages in the game yesterday, though, where they were very good. And they managed to get sucker punched twice in the first 20 minutes, even though they played a lot of football in that period. So you still think that when they're on it, they are capable of anything, really. But... Yeah, it's a test. But probably not the worst time for them to have a bit of an international break now, though, in a way. Rather than the momentum from this defeat sort of carrying on into something else, that they can maybe take stock a small bit and come back and go into this run where Liverpool have to head away, and that might just sort of...
Stop Liverpool a bit.
Well...
You hope,
yeah, you would think that...
Pep.
That's still going to be... It's still something new that they haven't encountered before. And... That it can be. I know that they're going to Qatar. It's not as if they're sort of, they'll probably have a pretty high class, first class flight to get there. So
yeah.
It's not as if it's going to be massively fatiguing. They might.
Everybody's in the flat beds.
It's not unusual for teams to nip off to Dubai mid season for a training break.
Yeah.
But it still is extra games. And I think if City are going to do anything, they need to probably have a perfect run as far as the new year anyway, and be sort of within sort of 4, 5, 6 points. I think if the gap remains at that size at the turn of the year, I think you can probably accept that it's over. But I think the time will be.
So really, yeah. It feels like all Liverpool need to do is get to the end of the World Club Championships with a 9-point lead, and from that point, you can't really see them blowing this.
Yeah, you can see it spacing out in January, and you know there's no European games at that point, and. You know, yeah. they can do whatever they want to do about the FA Cup, etc. Yeah. And so that's the winner. It's just Christmas coming off the back of this trip they've got coming up. That would be the only window where you think, okay, that'll test them. But I mean, their squad looks pretty deep, and you know that's an area that's been addressed. So you think they'll be able to handle it. But I just wouldn't declare it as over yet when they still have to come through that.
Claudio Bravo on goals, Walker, Stones, Fernandinho, and Angelino is your back four, and you've been in charge for 3 years, and basically. The club have been doing your bidding in the transfer market for about 18 months before that, and this is the back four and goalkeeper you put out for an early season title decider. Somebody somewhere needs to take responsibility for the fact that this City squad is not strong where it's supposed to be strong.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, they've also signed some players who I know, like Mendy's had injuries and so on. They've also signed some players that either haven't worked or Pep doesn't trust them, or yeah. You know. When they would have been sort of flagged as a marquee level of signing at the time, like Mendy, the summer he was brought in, it was like,
well,
they are addressing a problem position and strengthening in an ominous way. I mean, it's a bit unfortunate with a couple of the injuries, but like the whole measure of a title team is overcoming that. I mean, Liverpool did have to do without Alisson for a while at the start of the year. So like it's not exactly a sob story, the City situation. I mean, the poor is like it's lucky that he's out, but it's amazing that actually how they've struggled without him in particular, you know, and the extent to which the reliance on him. I know Sky reminded everyone a million times yesterday that the man in the studio, Vincent Kompany, wasn't replaced, but I mean ultimately he probably wasn't, you know, in terms of that sort of leadership type figure and
Could they make one last season? Because things haven't exactly worked out for Kompany. They've already turned Kompany into a director of football after.
Yeah, I know. It'd be an interesting career move for him. I kind of wonder, would it be one of these ones where, I mean, I'm going to say no, right? But let's just take this hypothetical scenario and imagine.
Why not, though?
It is one of these things where, obviously, Scholes come out of retirement, but I'm thinking of other examples. Like Stephen Carr was like an Irish example of a player who had so many injuries for most of his career and then like retired for a couple of months. And all of a sudden, just the inactivity like cleared up those problems. Came back, you know, fresher than ever and like got a season. Actually, Stephen Carr got a couple of seasons out of it, but I'm not really seeing it as a plausible scenario at this stage.
Well, if you're City, like, what do you... So I presume there's no transfer, it's not too late to add him to your supplement.
I know if someone's a free agent, but it depends. Like, I doubt he's registered as a player when he became manager, did he? I wonder. If he did, then they're screwed. They can't do that.
Okay,
If he's a completely free agent, then it's possible, but I don't know. I'm not sure if it's going to come to that, but I mean, they should have the depth to cope.
I know,
but they have the best academy team, and you speak to Kev and who would have Kev Kilbane, who would have sort of spoken to people at City about the amazing academy team that they have. You know, the sort of minimum salary, you know, they're all the best of the best recruited from around the world. Like, that's why when Gavin Bazunu went from here to Shamrock Rovers, there was so much excitement because you're going into this elite environment, but I suppose not ready-made in the sense that they're able... I mean, Angelino actually was there, then headed off to PSV and was brought back. So they've had a couple of them evolved and around the place, but maybe not to the extent that they're just ready-made to come in if there's a bit of a crisis.
I think Phil Foden was the only one from the academy on the bench yesterday. Jesus, Silva, Mahrez, Cancelo, Otamendi, Scott Carson and Phil Foden.
Yeah, it says Angelino was there and they went and
they
exercised the buyback. Yeah.
It
is true. Like,
one,
to have
one subpar left back and one sub who is unused for the biggest academy, best academy, most heavily invested in academy in world football. Like, it's not. It's the Man City experiment is not working.
I wonder though, is that the average rate though for like an academy presence? I know the Manchester United stats are incredible in terms of the number of sort of youth team products they generally have had around an unbroken run of having someone in the first team squad over a period of time.
Yeah, okay. So,
but even
one.
In the best case scenario, I'm not sure if an elite Premier League or La Liga club will have any more than 4 or 5, maybe. around the squad, you know?
Yeah.
That's probably the,
realistic.
Yeah, no, I think even, that's what you want to think you'd be aspiring towards, just that doubling of it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like, are they producing a certain type of player? You know, is your Hendon's broader debate was, is your academy is ever going to produce the completely sort of no nonsense centre half, you know, who they might actually need.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily the type of players that you associate with academy football, with under-23 football. They generally come to it from a different way.
Yeah, so actually Liverpool only had Trent Alexander-Arnold in theirs, I think.
It's never going to be any more than a couple, but they could probably do it more of a return if it is as sort of awesome as we are told that it is.
Yeah, otherwise it's just a souffle of hype.
It's an expensive one, but yeah. If they can get one or two players out of it when they're paying on average around 80 million a player, then what's the measure of it, then yeah. What's the measure of success like?
Yeah.
The City model seems to be that even if they don't necessarily make it at City, they do sell them on generally for a good price. I'm familiar with this from Gavin Bazunu's case from going from Rovers, that even if it doesn't happen for him at City, and he did actually travel with the first team squad to the game at Southampton recently, but Angus Gunn was the goalkeeper who was there before, who was sold for, I think it was like 12, 15 million quid off the top of the head. So the Chelsea one, you know, was more erratic in terms of the million players out on loan at various times, and their return was questionable.
Yeah, and now they're reaping the reward of
that. Chelsea actually are looking like a model one now.
Yeah.
They've got the 4 or 5.
Last question on this. Is this the beginning of the end for Pep? Like, is this the start of the end? We've seen the stress get to him at Barcelona. We've seen the relationship fracture with Bayern Munich. And it's a limited lifespan. It's not quite the Mourinho as predictable as clockwork as
the
Mourinho's
3-year
was.
Cycle with Mourinho.
A million miles away from it, though.
Yeah, no,
miles away.
I'm not so sure. I think he's still got stuff to do at City. As I said, they still have a Champions League campaign ongoing, so I'm sort of loath to declare it as like this is it. You know, I think that's still something to provide a firm focus to their season, even if the league doesn't drift. Then that becomes a stifling sort of pressure around their European games.
It does, yeah.
And maybe in March and April you're having this discussion again. But
luckily,
while that's there,
the games though. So.
Oh yes, yeah. Wow, such a charming project overall. The City one, really, isn't it?
Dave Carr on Twitter says Liverpool had Alisson out for 8 games and didn't drop a point. We were missing our centre half yesterday for the biggest game of the season. All teams get injuries. Get over it, he's basically saying.
Yeah, no, I don't think there's much of a City sub story at all in terms of like the injury problems they face. It's unfortunate to have a sort of a confluence of a couple of them at the same time, in the same area, but they should be equipped to deal with it.
Emma says Leicester on St. Stephen's Day is the real title decider.
They'll be coming back after, you know, still have sort of Qatari memories at that point,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That could be one of the games, yeah.
Points. Throws up weird and wonderful results sometimes. Mr. Celt Reggae on YouTube says, lads, do you think people are underestimating Chelsea and Leicester to a lesser degree? If Chelsea turn over City straight after the international break, they certainly won't be. I think Chelsea just finishing in the top 4 this year will be a remarkable result for Lampard, given that it's his first full season and the transfer ban.
Oh, it'd be great. If they are, and points at the moment, they're comfortably ahead of Arsenal, Spurs, Manchester United.
Third
would be an incredible season for Chelsea.
Yeah.
It really would.
And they should be aiming for second at the moment. I think that Man City are just going to, I don't know, I can't see City going on that amazing run. Here's what's coming up on the show for you. Kenny Cunningham, after his comments about Fabinho last week, he's back 8:05 this morning. So
a few comments about that I saw.
20 minutes, yeah, a lot of them. Use the hashtag OTBAM to get your questions in for Kenny Cunningham right now. So that's coming up 8:05. We're bringing the sports news around about 8:30. It's Klopp versus Pep at 8:40. And then talking rugby at the weekend with Alan Quillen ahead of the return of the European Cup, the Heineken Cup, back in action next weekend. 2 live games for you here on Off the Ball as well. And then Pits and Peaks from the weekend at 9:05. Now, time for the papers. OTB AM. Funnily enough, it is Pep wagging his finger. I'm not sure if that's like he was... He did the... Thank you so much. But then he did wave his finger as well at the referee.
He insisted he wasn't being sarcastic afterwards.
So seeing red, that is the ref at the end of the game, isn't it? That's not the fourth official in the middle of it. Because the fourth official, he had the 2 fingers up going, Two times.
Yeah, I think that might be the end of the game, all right. But
yeah.
I mean, there was plenty of sideline histrionics to choose from.
Yeah.
Photographer's dream, really.
It was pretty sensational. So that is the Telegraph this morning.
I've got the back of the Indo here. It's actually on the discussion we were just talking about, Eamon Sweeney. Guardiola's defence in tatters, and just includes a quote from Eamon's piece inside. Guardiola being something of an anomaly. And his has been an aristocratic football life, far from the ordinary worries which affect managers at other clubs, like the ones Klopp has dealt with so brilliantly. So certainly Eamon Sweeney coming down strongly on the, I suppose, the concerns about Pep side of things. Is Pep Guardiola overrated, I think, which was the intro, which might be a bit strong for me, but it's a point of view contrasted with so Jurgen Klopp's background at Mainz and has managed at a level of the game in a way that Pep hasn't, at a level that Pep hasn't managed that, and has it equipped them to deal with certain things. It's definitely a point of view.
Yeah, Barcelona B wasn't the equivalent. The Times here is Guardiola boils over. It's funny how he is the lead in the English papers. He's the main story in all the English papers. And then they've also got that Emery clings on at Arsenal for now. So word was leaking out yesterday from Arsenal, not officially, but they're going to give Emery until the end of the season. And then there's a nice little bit of detail here in the Times that there's a break clause at the end of the year, so you're going to have to pay him to the end of the year anyway. He may as well manage the club, and if he can turn it around, he turns it around. But they're still apparently interested in Mikel Arteta. Now, they had hired Mikel Arteta for this gig, basically with a, hand of, let's shake hands on this, Mikel. And then the phone went dead for 24 hours, and Unai Emery was suddenly the new manager at Arsenal the last time. So Arteta was super close to getting that job.
Yeah.
Would he go back now? Having, fooled me once.
He still needs to make that breakthrough to a certain level.
He is in the background, just there. That's him. So when Pep goes, who's next? It's him, right?
Yeah, well, that is the thing. Does he play the long game there? That is the tactical equation. Or will he really be trusted? Our City are going to, with their project and how they do things, is it going to be a first managerial job for someone, the City gig?
Maybe not. Maybe he'll have to go and Patrick Vieira's doing Nice, isn't he?
He's not doing, I don't think Vieira's doing especially well. Vieira's reputation has taken a bit of a dent,
right?
So
I was wondering, does it matter in some ways?
Vincent Kompany, of course, he's been shown to the side a bit. So
maybe Luis Enrique is in the mix for Arsenal, I'm being told.
Right, yeah. Is the City generation of, I don't know, Vieira didn't play for City as such, but the in the same way, Solskjaer coming back to United is like the legend. City aren't going to bring in Paul Dickov or Nicky Summerby. Do you know what I mean? They can't go to someone from their long, the 90s, early 2000s.
No.
They have to.
They don't have
enough of a recent dynasty to pluck into it, that emotive appointment. People thought when Henri went into management, well, this would be great, we'll get into Arsenal someday. Yeah. It hasn't really happened.
Well, I'm just looking at the
Give City a generation.
The Liga standings at the moment, and Nice are 13th.
Mm.
It's not great.
No. Hasn't sort of been rocking and rolling for a lot of that French generation of players people thought might be top managerial figures.
Good managers, yeah. Where do you go?
I got the mirror here. Thanks for nothing. Pep's all shook up at ref after VAR controversy rules out the Trent handball. That same picture, it does look like that picture actually was after the handball that was or wasn't early in the game. It's a sort of big controversy. I would have thought Bernardo Silva handball would have been significant in the build-up to it as well. The way things are sort of applied these days, but
yeah. So for which goal? Sorry,
first goal. Yeah, that actually it came off Bernardo Silva's hand first.
Yeah,
and then ricocheted across the area and came off Trent Alexander Arnold, obviously. And that was the flashpoint episode. But I mean, I know there's been a lot. To be honest, a lot of the VAR stuff is starting to bore me and bore me to tears because it just keeps going on and on and on. But I thought that the attacking player, if it hits their hand at any point in the attack, that they potentially, they're potentially vulnerable to being punished.
So that should have been a free out.
That seemed to be the view of, I think it was Bobby Madeley or someone was tweeting yesterday.
Can you play advantage?
This was the expert rule that
that should have been called back. That, free kick to
that if it had gone to VAR, yeah. then it wouldn't have been a penalty because of what happened with Bernardo Silva initially.
Yeah.
That seemed to be that was this official's take on it, as if this is a bit of a non-issue. And then there's another thing over how long they played on for.
Yeah.
Which certainly when the VAR came in, I remember there was a case in the MLS, which was one of the first leagues to trial it, and a sort of a similar nightmare scenario where there's an incident at one end, the other team breaks to the other and scores an amazing counter-attack sort of goal, and they eventually have to rule it off and call it back to give a penalty to the other side.
Yeah.
Sort of high drama, actually. But I just thought this one, I don't know, it was laboured on the Man City misfortune with this, but I would have thought if the ball had been booted out for a throw-in, say, rather than a Liverpool attack, I'm not sure if they would have got the penalty that they...
Yes, so they don't even get the penalty in that one. It is a penalty in the second half, though, right?
There's another
handball from Trent.
Oh, well, that was the one. The Sterling sort of from very close range.
Yeah, don't they always give those now?
Yeah.
It's almost like it's a...
Yeah, no, I know that in commentary they were adamant that it shouldn't be a penalty.
Right.
So, because it was so close.
I know, but is that just because...
Yeah, I don't know. I should mention as well, sorry, the John Cross as well, as you mentioned, Arsenal would not be bullied by noisy fans to sack Emery. And then you have the Kerry final as well, which features across a couple of papers as well.
The Herald, the back page of the Herald this morning is, we can deal with heat, Klopp, what pressure asks Red Boss as City humbled. I don't think they're going to feel pressure from being 9 points up this time the way they would last season, for example. And it wasn't a real 9-point lead last year anyway, wasn't it? There were games in hand, etc.
Yeah, no, but they had it, but they still had enough of a lead to consider it blowing it a small bit. No, I know what you mean. It was also City's relentless run.
Yeah.
It was pretty impressive as well. I was in front of the Examiner Sport. Here, you're going for the mail.
No, yeah, sorry. Yeah, yeah. Pepso Mad is just and it's just the same thing again. And then Clifford's are new rulers of Kingdom. Dr. Crook's dreams of a fourth successive county title were crushed yesterday by a rampant East Kerry.
Yeah, so I mean, the front page of the Examiner Sports section is headed in the right direction. Reds open 8-point lead. And also as well, yeah, just the Clifford's and the Kerry story below. Anthony Daly, provincial titles won't do Ballygunner anymore. And then there's a reference to the racing at Navan, which I think will come on to the Racing Post. You mentioned that.
Yeah, yeah. So there was a big shock in the racing.
There was some good racing. Yeah, Apple's Jade was beaten yesterday. But it was really, really good racing at Navan. You can tell the winter is drawing in when the old household name horses are popping out again.
The Express, the back page there is, hand it to Reds. And, Pep Guardiola with his hand out, his fingers up, pointing, shaking hands, thanks very much.
It's kind of, here we go again. Back of the sun, we have again Pep with the two fingers up again. Did it cause a craze in Korea or somewhere?
Oh, did it?
Where I think like his symbol is synonymous with like some very popular band or something. It's
going
viral there in a very different way. This is like massive news. Maybe I can't remember what the specifics were. We can pop it up. Again, Pep rages as ref ignores two pen claims. It was the Sun. It's crazy. And Klopp saying, I can't believe we're 8 points clear. And also, it's across a couple of the papers. Owen Kaiser, he's going. Aaron Connolly, a doubt for the Ireland's games with New Zealand and Denmark. He went off at half-time yesterday with a groin injury. And I think Mick McCarthy initially just thought he was taken off at half-time because Brighton were losing.
Yeah.
But actually, it's a bit more serious. So he's meant to make his home debut on Thursday at the Aviva. So it'd be pretty frustrating for him if he missed out.
Yeah, OK. The Irish Times is, Guardiola calls for clarity on handball decisions, and then concern over Connolly ahead of crucial Denmark date is that story that we've just been talking about. And Munster and Connacht resources stretched as European action looms. Obviously, the return of the Heineken Cup at the weekend. We'll be talking in detail about that with Alan Quinlan a little bit later on. David McGoldrick did well at the weekend.
Excellent. He was really, really good.
Did score.
He did score. We're not going into another...
His bonus.
But it was one of these VAR moves where, it was like five passes back into the sort of the play in American football terms. And it's actually a brilliant ball by Enda Stevens from McGoldrick. Sort of a sense of atonement for Stevens because he made a mistake a few moments earlier.
For the goal.
And then puts in a terrific pass and McGoldrick scored. And of course, we were in here at the time. It was around the time Stephen Kelly, and I don't know if you saw this over the weekend.
Yes, we did.
Do we even dwell on this? Stephen Kelly speaking about how, his grandfather had fought in the war and...
So he didn't mind wearing the poppy.
Yeah, didn't mind. Very, and like, so, sometimes the topic of other Irish players wearing the poppy is a bit of an elephant in the room to a degree, in the sense that obviously James McLean has taken a stance,
yeah,
and other players wouldn't have taken the stance,
yeah,
and you feel sometimes he's been left flying solo on it a bit. So you have to put the question to someone, and Stephen Kelly answered just around the time that Sheffield United scored. And actually, Kieran Clarke scored for Newcastle, and he belted, put him under pressure in the studio just at the wrong moment. But yeah, I'm sure so people can see that clip.
On Saturdays, yeah, when an Irish player scores in the Premier League, a quick blast of put him under pressure happens.
Yes.
Where did you stand on the Off poppy, Stephen? Was it just something that was put on the jersey and you put it on?
Yeah, like I wouldn't be as forthcoming as McLean would have been not to wear. It was just one of those things. It was put on the jersey, I wore and got on with it. I didn't see it as being disrespectful or anything. You know, my granddad fought in both World Wars, so it was kind of okay. You know what I mean? Yeah, for the English Army. It was more, you know, I understand why in Ireland we don't wear it because of all the troubles and what was happening with the British Army and stuff like that. So it's, you know, from that sense. But and when I was playing in England, I was playing for the team, I was just respecting what their wishes were, basically.
Well, I don't know if that's the most appropriate timing of all time.
Let's take a moment to remember.
Yeah.
I'll apologise straight up, Stephen. That should not that
I think we've abused the poppy there. We've actually all our fallen
okay,
heroes.
See, that's probably the most... Like,
was it Tranmere Rovers who also abused the poppy at the weekend with the poppy mascot? Was
yeah,
that
the suggestion, there's a suggestion that might have been from last year, but it went around on Saturday. It could have happened this year. I mean, it's not as if we've taken a more reasoned stance across the course of the 12 months. Yeah, it was the giant mascot and sort of clown shoes.
Yeah.
As was pointed out, the poppy wasn't actually wearing a poppy, so was that disrespectful?
Oh, totally, yeah. I mean, if it is a poppy, does it have to wear a poppy?
Where does the poppy end?
Yeah.
Does it have to be a poppy within that poppy? I mean,
that's the whole point.
Where does it stop the cycle of the poppy?
Yeah, anything else in the papers?
We've got The Guardian here again. A similar team, take it as red. Liverpool move, eight clear. At the top of Guardiola fumes about VAR, so it's a familiar point. And also, the Racing Post, the front page, Navin shock. As 1-4, Apple's has no answer to Bacardi's. That's, yeah, Apple's Jade. Shortest price defeat of her racing career. Lost to Bacardi's, but really good racing at Navan generally. So
Bacardi's was supposed to be a great horse. Like, that everybody was piling into a couple of Cheltenham's back.
Bacardi, kind of, yeah,
to deceive a bit and then came back. And so he's obviously a good horse.
Yeah, really good horse. He's actually sort of had a slightly, has like erratic jumping record in terms of, like, fell at the last in the stairs hurdle 1 year and almost when you expect Bacardi's to deliver, it hasn't always happened. When chasing, didn't quite fire, but on his day, very talented and showed it yesterday. So there's a Paul Nicholls stable turn, the Racing Post as well, 8 pages of it there. I was reading through it earlier. So the winter is around. There's some really good horse racing over the weekend, some really exciting young horses. Andy Dufresne at Navan yesterday, great name, and great horse by the looks of it. So JP McManus, possibly possible star of the future, that will become one of those names across the winter that people will be become attached to.
Beat somebody good, Andy Dufresne?
It was a good maiden hurdle, right. Like one of these really good early season hurdles, and there was a Willie Mullins horse in the race, Rich Ritchie, which didn't actually really fire, but almost it didn't matter in a way. Andy Dufresne won so impressively. It wouldn't have been stopped by anyone, I don't think.
All right, and then some of the rugby from the weekend. Blues, an ideal place to begin their drive for five. This is an intercept try that just put the tin hat on it for James Lowe against Connacht over at the Sports Ground. The game was over after about 15 minutes because Leinster had already racked up 3 tries at that point, but it was a bit of a paddling for Connacht. And then Munster won down and dirty against Ulster in at home and at the weekend as well for that one. And then in the GA, the big story, obviously, East Kerry winning the Kerry title, which means Austin Stacks are actually going to go ahead and play for Kerry in the Munster Championship because they won the Kerry Championship as opposed to the...
This is a bit of an alien world to me. But I love the fact that it has an impact on the captaincy as well. For, like, David Clifford could be Kerry captain now.
So, and it, well, Jack Sherwood or Darren Moynihan as well are on the team, but maybe you just give it to Clifford and you go...
That seems to be what people were talking about yesterday.
So there's a picture of the goal there as well. So they beat Dr. Crokes, who obviously have dominated the last decade, and there's a strong shout that it's going to be East Kerry's decade next. So it's funny, that team that wins yesterday gets to nominate the captain, not the team who won the earlier Kerry, whatever it's called, championship. county final. Mm. So you know that the clubs all play in the county final and they have a championship later on where...
Yeah, look, I was familiar. So there's something about it that's different to the others, but it's all...
Yeah, it's funny how... It's funny how Kerry have been doing this since the year dot and they're the winningest team in the history of... And most other counties are going, Jesus, it's a bit complicated, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe we should look at this in some shape or form. Yeah,
exactly. So, yeah. Like, because obviously... Clifford's from a junior club and wouldn't get this level of club competition unless they had the opportunity to do this. Although they're not junior anymore, I don't think, but they would have been in the past. And loads of players who only played for little small teams get to step up and test themselves against better competition.
Interesting. Very good soccer player, Clifford, as well, actually.
Is he, yeah?
Oh, he was, yeah. He played in, a lot of representative tournaments and stuff when he was younger, up until like 14, 16.
Right. Like, somebody needs to go down and tap him on the shoulder and say, come on.
Well, he's a centre-half.
Right.
He was a very good centre-half. So I've spoken to a couple of players from Kerry who've made their way in the game, who've played against them, and all very complimentary. Not necessarily convinced, he would have been a star, but... Definitely good enough to like operate at a decent level if he'd wanted.
Yeah, okay. And St Thomas has won the Galway Senior Hurling Championship title. That's their fourth win this decade. Clearly the team of the decade. They won their first ever in 2012, so congratulations to them as well. All right, if there's some of the pictures from around the weekend. That's St Thomas, I think. And then here is the Irish News. Thugs, no. Bullies, no. The best hurlers in Ulster. Shock Neil boss McShane hails players after final win over Dunloy. So Shock Neil are Ulster club hurling champions. And then the lead on offtheball.com this morning, Jurgen Klopp welcomes Sean Cox and his family to Anfield. It was a wonderful day. Pictures of the game of himself and Van Dijk afterwards. And we've got a poll running as well. Is it way too early? Oh, come on. 66% of you think it's too early to be crowning Liverpool champions. I'm not so sure. Chelsea are too inconsistent. City's defence are in ribbons. Leicester aren't winning the league this year, right? So, where's the little things? Tell me how you voted, Tommy. Did you Photoshop that out? Did you?
That's pretty intelligent. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Diplomatic.
All right. 2 minutes past eight. Football next here on OTB AM. Kenny Cunningham is going to join us after this.
OTB. AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
They spoke about your arm not being down beside your side. I mean, this is not Irish dancing.
OTB Sports Radio.
Basketball would have been my main game.
The brand new sports radio station from Off the Ball.
That's my point. Don't play for us if you're a proud Englishman.
Now broadcasting 24 hours a day, live on the Go Loud app, Alexa.
You have a whole new world of possibilities.
Google Home, TuneIn, and offtheball.com/radio.
This is OTB Sports Radio. OTB AM.
That second goal will point out to you just how instrumental they are and how good they are. The way Alexander Arnold has hit that crossfield ball to Robertson and the way Robertson has taken it in his stride and whipped it in to Salah, who, don't get me wrong, Salah's going to get a lot of plaudits for it, but the way they set the goal up was just exceptional. Their technical ability, their energy levels, their determination, the all-round game for both of them is just beyond anybody else in this league. And the difference between their fullbacks and City's fullbacks, who, to be fair, Walker got into some good positions, but when he got there you just didn't feel he was going to deliver the way Alexander Arnold does. And then on the other side, some good crossing, but not what you expect. And he did set up a goal, but Liverpool's fullbacks were just out of this world.
Liverpool's fixture list for the next month or so is pretty favourable. None of the big six teams, Manchester City, take on Chelsea, Manchester United and Arsenal in that stretch. So we're probably entering a different phase of the title race in terms of Liverpool are going to play games they have been winning, will be expected to win, that it's now going to become a more mental thing. The 30 years without a title, all the pressure that comes with that and playing with this club. Do you think that's actually going to be a factor?
I don't think so. What you see with this Liverpool team is you don't feel like there's a banana skin in their fixtures. You don't feel like they're going to throw a game away. Even if they're down in a game, they've got enough about them to come back, which they've done so many occasions throughout the season. When they're not playing well and they're under the cosh, they somehow turn it around and get a win. They've got a very strong mentality, and Klopp has turned them into this team of winners, and that's what they want to do. They never give up a game. And when you're looking at them out there, like I said, the two shots on target and they were 2-0 up. It was exceptional play from them. And they just look like a side that can go on and win it.
Yeah, Stephen Kelly and Nathan there giving their post-match reaction at Anfield after the 3-1 victory yesterday. Game was obviously live on Off the Ball. Now, Kenny Cunningham is with us again to talk to us about what happened. Kenny, the point the lads were making there is the one that Stephen was making essentially was that he doesn't think that the pressure is going to get to Liverpool. I have to say, I would agree with that, given that this is a team who've come through a Champions League campaign. It's not like this is like all the other Liverpool teams over the last 30 years. This is the best one, and they are a team of seasoned winners who've gone toe-to-toe at Man City last year. So is the pressure going to be an issue for you, do you think?
No, well, it won't be. Pressure will be an issue, but will it be an issue in terms of where they're suddenly going to freeze and hand the title to Manchester City or another? No. They won't, probably for the reasons that you're saying. It's just that experience, Jerry, of last year, of coming there so close last year to have the title kind of taken away from them. You just sense that that hunger, that kind of drive, resolve, it's all been hardened over the summer, that kind of inner determination and even kind of belief off the back of the Champions League victory that they can go and do it this time around. It's pretty much inevitable, I think, after the summer that Liverpool were going to win a league title. You could sense it was just a case of when. So it's no real surprise that they're in the position that they're in. In terms of 9-point lead, yeah, I don't think too many were envisaging maybe that kind of disparity at this stage of the season. But for me, it's not so much. I think they'll go and win it. Obviously, I thought they'd win at the start of the season. But the position they're in at the moment, and looking at, most importantly, Manchester City's position, how kind of fragile they are in terms of injuries to key personnel. I'm thinking of Laporte in particular. They were a little bit weak there before the start of the season, even with Laporte being fit, you know, him being out. They've got a real problem there in the defence. So for me, if I was in Liverpool's point of view, I'd be looking at Liverpool maybe even maintaining this lead and even extending it now between now and the end of the season. I think that's a real possibility. They're so strong. And it's our mental strength as well, just kind of, Jared, just as much of their physical attributes, you know, their collective strength, individual qualities which they have, which we've all spoken about. For me, it's the kind of the strong characters you're talking about and just that kind of mental strength and determination, hunger now, almost like a primal thing that we're going to get this done this season. So, yeah, to cut a long story short, I think it's theirs and I think they'll go and win it.
Yeah, OK. Let's talk a little bit about City before we come back to Liverpool, because I talked about this a little bit earlier on, but they're back five: Claudio Bravo, Kyle Walker, Stones, Fernandinho and Angelino. This is the team that he was apparently forced to pick to play the biggest game of the season. And here we are 3 years into the Pep Guardiola experiment. He could certainly for the first 2 years sign any players in the world that he wanted. And it's an injury to Aymeric Laporte has left him in this position where they're so fragile at the back. So somebody somewhere has to take responsibility for how that squad was built and how it's not actually able to deal with the vagaries of a title race.
Yeah, well, they dealt with it last year. I would say that it's the same kind of predominantly kind of group of players that went and won the league title last year. So it's not as if this squad of players can't win. But they won last year, even with those kind of small deficiencies that we're talking about, particularly across the defensive line. Obviously, with Laporte fifth, the majority of last season, he was the best defender for me. He was actually a good boy from Guardiola. Give him credit for that. But he kind of pulled the whole thing together from last season. Stones hasn't made those great strides forward under Guardiola. A lot of people thought that he would. And it is interesting that a lot of talk about how individual players have flourished under Guardiola, how they've improved. Sterling's probably the latest example of that. Predominantly, you're probably talking about forward-thinking players, kind of goal scorers. When you look at actually the defenders, not too many defenders I can think of offhand who Guardiola has brought into the football club. And 2-3 years down the road, you could say, do you know what? He's a far better defender now than when he was when Guardiola first brought him into the football club. And he can make that argument for Stones. He can make it for Walker as well. He has been a reasonably successful signing Walker. But in terms of defensive attributes, that hasn't improved at all. So, yeah, there was real weaknesses across the defensive line, even bringing Mendy in or wherever at left back. I don't think Mendy is the strongest defensive. I don't think he would have greatly strengthened that team. Otamendi, of course, doesn't strengthen the team when he comes in. So the problem was pre-season, not bringing a centre half into the football club. Talk about he was interested in Maguire. Didn't follow through on that. I'm not exactly sure Maguire was the exact prototype fit for me. The young boy at Ajax, for me, I was very surprised they didn't push. They didn't push strongly to get him delict into the football club. Yes, very young, but an outstanding defender who was only going to get better. So that was the mistake. Whether it was Guardiola's or the recruitment team, I'm not too sure, Jer. But certainly they're paying for it now.
We talked about it last week on the show where I was making the point that maybe they're a bit unfortunate to go out of the Champions League against Spurs in the fashion that they did, but the counter-argument was that their defence was so poor that night that actually that's what happens in the Champions League. You come up against world-class strikers who are able to do random things, and unless you actually have a really solid defence, you can't really aspire to win the Champions League either. And so at the moment, it looks like all their eggs are in the Champions League basket for this season and whether or not it's going to be a success. And on the basis of what their defence was yesterday, and maybe the defence improves when they get their keeper back, and maybe this is a bit premature, but it doesn't appear as if they've got a Champions League winning defence at the moment either.
I think there's a stronger argument for saying they could still, they're still contenders in the Champions League. Obviously, the keeper comes back in the next few weeks. Laporte comes back to get him fit for the tail end of the Champions League. It's not about how you start the Champions League, Jared, you know, it's how you finish the second half of the season. And Laporte coming back into that team, the goalkeeper certainly strengthens them. The problem is not just with Manchester, it's how they play as well. Jared, sometimes you have a small weakness in your defence, you can kind of protect yourself a little bit in terms of how you set up. You know, if you're nice and compact, maybe you drop deep to the edge of your penalty box, you don't open yourself up, you don't leave those players isolated. I'm talking about kind of Otamendi here and those defenders that we're talking about. You know, if the collective defensive unit is strong enough, you can kind of get away with it at times. You can manage. But the way City play, they open themselves up. They send their full-backs high up the pitch. Centre-halves get exposed in 1v1 situations. So if you have a weakness, particularly a centre-half, playing at a club like Manchester City, the way Guardiola wants to play, it's extremely difficult to do that with those small weaknesses which he has. But the ball retention is that good at times. They dominate possession so much, score so many goals. Again, it's not as if this team hasn't won. The surprise to me yesterday was Guardiola actually changed. The big surprise was he changed in terms of the tactical setup. He actually went 4-4-2, really. He played De Bruyne as a number 10 in behind Aguero, and that surprised me. And I think that hinders Manchester City more so than anything else. Gary Neville made a big thing after the game. Very surprised Guardiola didn't go to a back three and really surprise us. But for me, he needed to stick with the tried and tested 4-3-3 because I think they weren't as fluid. They didn't look as fluid in possession, not as cohesive as when they played that V-shaped in midfield. For me, it would have been Rodri at the base yesterday with Gundogan and De Bruyne. If you're going to play those two, if Silva wasn't fit enough to play those two in those advanced positions, because City at their best in possession is when their wide men are stretching opposition defences across the pitch, and De Bruyne and any other, whether it's Gundogan or Silva, they're making those darting runs in behind opposition fullbacks in centre halves, really causing problems, really asking questions of opposition teams. Does the centre half come out and deal with it? Does the holding midfielder have to drop in there? I think that would have been a problem for Fabinho yesterday if he had to do that. He's a very good player for being, but one of his small deficiencies is a lack of mobility. And I think he would have struggled to deal with those runs of Gundogan or De Bruyne into those inside left and right channels. But by playing De Bruyne as a number 10, I think it let Liverpool off the hook a little bit. And for me, kind of City suffered a little bit because of it. They weren't at their best and probably didn't create as many clear-cut opportunities as they generally would have done in their normal kind of setup.
Yeah, so they didn't actually take the opportunity to exploit the weakness in... I'll come back to that, the Liverpool side of that in 1 second, but this isn't the first time that Guardiola has changed things for a big game. Sometimes you feel like maybe he gets in his own head.
It's an easy one after the fact. Like you said, a lot of commentaries, enjoyed the commentary yesterday, but a lot of the talk before was he's got to change. He can't go into this game with that kind of a flat back four with a pairing of Stones and Fernandinho with someone as inexperienced as kind of Alan Gini. He has to try something a little bit different. Now, he did try something a little bit different, but it wasn't across the back four line. I wouldn't agree with that statement. He should have gone to a back three. If a back three meant bringing Otamendi into the defensive setup, for me, you're never going to be strengthened by bringing Nicolas Otamendi into the team, no matter what system that you play. So for me, the back four was the way to go forward. And there's nothing you can do about the deficiency you've got across the defensive line. All you can do is play the system which best suits the players, which means you dominate possession of football and which is going to give you the opportunity to create chances and score goals. I think their only chance yesterday, City, was to actually outscore Liverpool. When I saw that City team, I thought, well, you're probably looking at, I would have given a bet on Liverpool scoring at least two goals against that Manchester City team. So the only chance they had was actually to outscore them. And by kind of tweaking the system, which he did, for me, that kind of restricted Manchester City a little bit in their ability to go and get two, three, four goals or wherever they needed to go and get a point or 3 points against Liverpool yesterday.
Kenny, you last time you were with us, Kenny, you blew up the internet when you were talking about Fabinho.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. Hell hath no fury like a Liverpool fan scorned. They took it personally that you were pointing out that Fabinho... Yeah. You said, looking at the goals Liverpool have conceded this season, it's been down to Fabinho's lack of alertness, which isn't exactly that controversial. But then, I'm not totally convinced about him in that holding midfield position. Obviously, you still think he's a good player, but did City not do enough to try and get at him, or did he just play well?
No, he had a... If you want to talk about Fabinho, his performance yesterday probably typified what I'm talking about, Fabinho, in terms of strengths and his weaknesses. Obviously a brilliant individual goal, that was fantastic, but put that to the side, in possession, very easy on the eye, good little fulcrum for Liverpool there when they're in possession, they can pop the ball into him, he gets himself in the half turn, keeps the ball moving very efficiently. There was one turn on the halfway line first half, and City put the squeeze on him, Gundogan, he just dropped his shoulder, turned on his inside and just left him for dead and played a forward pass, was brilliant. And that's the strength of Fabinho. But if you look at his defensive side of his game yesterday, don't get clouded by the fact that it was a great victory for Liverpool. I mean, he should have got booked after 20 minutes. Gundogan dropped his shoulder on and went past him. And that lack of mobility, you could see it there, couldn't plant his feet and recover, actually hacked him down, should have got a yellow card. If you looked at a couple of chances City got first half, De Bruyne put a ball through his legs for Angelino, hit the post. De Bruyne spun him on the halfway line. He tried to win a ball in front, got it wrong. De Bruyne spun away from played Aguero win, flashed a shot across the goal. And even second half, I mean, Sterling danced around him a couple of times and possibly could have scored. De Bruyne had done him on the outside, put a ball across the penalty box for Aguero, should have scored. And even the goal that Manchester City scored, I thought he was a little bit weak in his defending against De Bruyne inside the box. So, I mean, you put it on me there. That's just off the top of my head. It's about six or seven situations there for me. Actually could have done better and almost indirectly caused his team a goal. But for me, look, the argument isn't that Fabinho's a good or bad player. He's a very good player, but you need to understand the qualities which he has. And Klopp clearly feels those attributes I've spoken about, he values them more than the defensive, the lack of defensive qualities which he has. And it's interesting, you look at all the successful championship winning teams, maybe the last kind of 10 years, Fernandinho is probably the best example of Manchester City, how strong he is defensively. Kante at Leicester and Chelsea, even back to, I'm thinking, Matic at Chelsea, all better defenders than Fabinho on that central area of the pitch. But where Fabinho has the edge on those three players is in terms of the quality of his passing, his ability to receive the ball in tight areas, keep the ball moving and just work the ball up the pitch. He's a decent reader of the game as well, so he's a very good player in possession. I am a fan of him, but he makes me a little bit nervous when Liverpool haven't got possession of the ball. That's why I make the argument in certain games, for me, Henderson is the better option, that holding midfield position. But it's not a case of if Pavino is a good or bad player. He is a very good player, of course he is. It's just a case of which of those attributes which he has, which do you value more? And clearly at the moment, those attributes which he has when Liverpool are in possession, Klopp clearly feels best kind of complements the players around them.
You can see why if you're Klopp, though, that you would want that on your team, because last season that was something that the last 18 months basically people have said that central midfield area for Liverpool is not creative enough. You know they're not really a team who likes to have the ball, but with him in it, at least you can keep the ball for a little while and you can play a slightly different style. You can temper your style mid game if you need to.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and that's a very good argument. So I've no problem with that argument, as long as you recognise those small deficiencies in Fabinho's game, and you say, well, yeah, I know that, I understand that, but in terms of what he brings to the team, when we have the ball, his ability to receive the ball off centre half, off full backs on the inside, unlike Jordan Henderson, who generally his first touch takes him back towards the goal, and maybe it's a backwards or a sideways pass. That is not always the case with Fabinho. His head's up a little bit more. He's checking his shoulder. He can receive the ball on the half turn. He can actually break the lines with his passing forward. Doesn't have to be a scintillating 40-yard daisy cutter across the pitch. Sometimes it's just a 10, 15 yards forward pass. Yeah, that just breaks the lines and gets the likes of maybe Salah or Mane coming on the inside, the ball into their feet. And that's massive. You're playing half a dozen of those balls during the course of the 90 minutes. That's really significant. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. His ability to keep possession of the ball, keep calm and just keep the ball moving in those situations, I think it is a Henderson is an asset to the team, and it's why he's in the team ahead of Henderson in that respect, because he is better at that, as you've mentioned. Like I said, it's just one man's wine is another man's poison. You have to just, every single game, you have to look and say, which of those players do I want in the team at any given time? And he's shown a lot of loyalty towards Fabinho the last year, and I can understand why. But for me, this, maybe it's just me, defensive mentality, whatever it is, when I look up the pitch, what type of player I want to see in front of me, particularly in games when you're coming against sides of the strength of Manchester City, you're not going to dominate possession. You're going to be penned in for long periods. For me, it's the player with the better defensive attributes, which would be the one maybe I'd be yearning to be sitting in front of me. But it's a great position for Klopp to be in, to have players of those individual qualities who he can go to week in, week out. And it's the strength of the squad, the different options he has now in that central area of the pitch. We haven't spoken about Oxlade-Chamberlain, Keita, top quality players as well, who we can bring into the team. So the squad strength's so good at the moment. I mean, it must be a joy to be a Liverpool supporter.
Yeah, absolutely. Kenny, great stuff this morning. Thanks, William, for joining us.
Nice one, lads.
Kenny Cunningham giving us some thoughts there.
I don't think the Liverpool fans got the apology that they wanted.
No, they didn't.
They didn't.
No.
Definitely, when I saw...
They doubled down.
When it was mentioned last night that he was on, there was a lot of comments. It was like... I mean, I suppose there is something about the football fan, even when their team is successful, that they need a focal point sometimes. They need to be shoving it to someone when their team scores. Well, like now at the moment, it's like,
especially when they're winning.
Cunningham, you know, this is it now. Like we have to stick it to Cunningham. So Fabinho scores in the moment of celebration, rather than drinking in the moment, like reveling in the majesty of the strike. It's like let's aim some invective in the direction of that pundit who expressed an opinion that may not have been 100% complimentary towards my club.
He's very wise in that he's not on social media, or at least if he is, he manages to keep...
He's not tailoring his actions accordingly then.
Exactly.
He's not as a rampant populist.
Yeah. And he had 6 or 7 good points there.
Yeah, and to be honest, like some of the responses is just a bit sensitive. I mean, the suggestion that Kenny is like a wind-up merchant. I mean, no, he actually offers... tends to actually be a pundit who offers a sort of a justification for his opinion. Now, you can chip away at it.
Yeah,
absolutely,
the Liverpool fan sites were all very eager to put it out there.
Yeah.
Because, it does good business for them.
It does.
Because literally nobody else saying anything about Liverpool other than, wow, what a great team.
They're amazing.
What a runaway train success you are.
It must be someone that we can pin to this virtual dressing room. It's not even a dressing room wall. Like, it's more to get the punters aggrieved. I have a couple of people in touch with me. It was like, get on to Cunningham there. It's like,
there you go.
He's explaining his views. Like, he's offering a footballing viewpoint.
Yeah, and well thought out too. Right, it is 22 minutes past 8 this morning. We're going to talk more about the Irish in the Premier League and some other stuff from the weekend, because the award ceremonies have started to come thick and fast. First, though, Sean Cox, the Irish Liverpool fan who suffered life-changing injuries in an attack outside the Liverpool-Roma game in April 2018, returned to Anfield yesterday for the very first time since the attack. His wife Martina spoke with Nathan before the game. Have a look.
Well, Martina, this, I'm sure, no doubt, is a bittersweet day in many ways for the family. Sean back watching his beloved Liverpool, but for the family, been so close to the scene of the incident that night. How are the emotions on a day like this?
Pretty high, to be honest. It's great to have him back, but at the same time, it is bittersweet. Sean's coming back in a different capacity. He's in a wheelchair. He's got lifelong injuries. But look, it's a good day, and we're really going to enjoy it. And I think it'll be a great boost for Sean.
How is Sean?
Yeah, he's good. He's doing well. He's in a rehab facility in Sheffield. He's been there since September, so he's starting to make progress. They're happy with him. There's a lot of different therapies that he's getting here that he didn't necessarily get back home, which is really good. So he's making progress. He's in the hydro pool. With the help of two therapy assistants, he's walking. He does need a lot of assistance to walk, but I think with time and a lot more intensive rehab, he will improve, and that's a good thing,
Jurgen Klopp was writing in his pre-match programme notes about you and the family and the courage and the spirit that you've shown. have you been over the last few months, particularly having to move away from home and come over here to where Sean is getting his treatment in Sheffield?
Yeah, it's been tough for the family. Like, I'm here with Sean and the children are at home. They're kind of commuting back and forth. We're actually out of our house at the minute, so they're living in rented accommodation. So it's a little bit topsy-turvy, but we're just doing it. It's for Sean. It's all about Sean's recovery. And, you know, being there, I think, has been really good for Sean, encouraging him. And he needs that, you know.
And what does having a day like this, the biggest match of the season, coming to Anfield, sold out, the support that he has gotten, you and his family have got, of the support, he's been able to come here, what do you think it means to him?
It means a lot, and it means an awful lot to the family. Like, you know, without the support and, you know, all the fundraising, what LFC have done, you know, we wouldn't be in Sheffield with Sean, and he wouldn't be getting the care. So that means everything to us. Yeah.
Well, I hope Sean enjoys the game. I hope you and the family enjoy the game. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks.
It's Martina Cox speaking about her husband Sean and the journey that he's on at the minute as he recovers from that horrific attack, and Liverpool obviously helping as much as they can at the moment.
Yeah, they've dealt very well with it as a club, I think. You know, they would have probably received some maybe initial criticism, but they've certainly...
Bit slow to get going.
They've made him a part of the...
It feels like Klopp is kind of responsible for that too. That, like, because when, you know, they have the advertising hoardings, this means more, and it's like either that's true or it's not. And if it's a marketing slogan, then we'll all see through it. And certainly at the start, it looked like they were kind of just keeping things at arm's length. But then I think that changed. I don't know. And it feels like Klopp was involved in that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, but it's a story that should strike a chord with any football club, any football-going fan. You know,
yeah.
The absolute randomness of it. So
I think, funnily enough, James Coleman had a role in all that too, when he was the one who was kind of like, this isn't about Liverpool versus Everton. This is about football fans. A man goes to a football match and... doesn't come home the same, you know.
Yeah.
And that, look, the struggle for the family is unbelievably real as well, you know, like their life in Meath has been turned upside down. They're had to move to Sheffield too.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
this is an ongoing back and story. Forth.
Yeah, no, there's only so much of a happy ending that can be achieved, you know, in this scenario. But like, you know, the fact that he was there yesterday at the game, and that in itself is a massive degree of progress, but yeah, I can only wish them the best with that.
No, for sure. 27 minutes past 8 this morning. If you want to get in touch, you can use the hashtag OTBAM on Twitter, or you can leave a comment on our YouTube or Facebook streams, or maybe you're listening on Go Loud. You can always text us as well. We have a WhatsApp number which we keep forgetting to plug in. Tommy's looking at me going, don't mention this. Don't mention this.
It's just a lot of Kenny Cunningham messages, to be honest. Voice notes in Kenny Cunningham's direction.
Yeah. Or picks that are unpublishable. Yeah. So, big weekend for Irish football. The PFAI Awards were on.
The PFAI Awards were on Saturday. Yeah. It's always this time of year. It always coincides with like an international window coming upon us. So, you know, Mick McCarthy was there. Stephen Kenny was there.
Sitting at the same table?
I actually don't know if they were. No, I think they were different tables.
Right.
They actually were different tables. And yeah, I mean, like, primarily it's celebrating the domestic year being over, but I mean, Andy Stevens was also represented because he won the Overseas Player of the Year award. Denise O'Sullivan wasn't there, but there was a women's award as well. Bit of a controversy with Michelle O'Neill getting the Referee of the Year award, even though she didn't actually referee a game and she was an assistant referee throughout the season. So I'm not sure if that went down that well with the room or some of the people in the room. But yeah, it is that time of year, and the awards dues are all coming our way. All the end of the season stuff is coming our way, but it's slightly different this time when you've got, I mean, this day week Ireland play Denmark in a Euro 2020 qualifier, and the fact that you have, say, Jack Byrne, and I was speaking a bit about Jack and a bit more, but you have the award winner who was actually in that squad, you know, who's actually going to play against New Zealand on Thursday.
Yeah.
So it's actually a very clear link between this event and the international
play,
break.
Or is he going to Ryan Manning play?
No, he will play on Thursday.
Yeah,
yeah, that promise has been made. I think right. I think that was maybe a warning from not to enjoy himself too much in the night, that you are playing on Thursday. Your season is not over.
Yeah.
So I think that message was received. So he will be involved. But that was a good night. Even Nathan Murphy presented an award.
Oh, did he? What award did he present?
He was presenting the First Division Player of the Year award.
All right, the glamour.
Yeah, he was
that quiet.
Yeah, he kept it under wraps. But on Saturday. Myself and Johnny, we all left here to head off to it. We're glad rags.
And Johnny was working at it, I saw.
Yeah, Johnny was doing his red carpet stuff.
Right.
I have to say, he's pretty good at it, but there's a wild card element to it that you just never, that it's not live, which is probably, there's probably a good aspect to it. There's like a real familiarity with the players. Like, he breaks into doing impressions, which...
Of the players?
No, but he, like, with a couple of the Dundalk lads, he did an impression of their coach, Rory Higgins, which is an impression he tends to wheel out on average 10 to 14 times a week. And he managed to do it with a microphone, in a microphone scenario.
Right.
And it worked pretty well. But, like, you know, it's a good old night. It is, like, horribly well-worn cliched stuff, but, like, you know, you don't really get that many people together under the same roof in a social environment too often.
Yeah.
And I guess, like, you know, one of the great things about covering the league that a lot of us who report on it regularly would speak about is, like, generally the access to players that exist. But even within... You know, there is a sort of, as much as there's rivalries within the league, generally a lot of people will get on reasonably well because a lot of them want the same thing and have had shared experiences and can empathise with each other a lot. And this is a good night. And not as fraught as recent years when, you know, the FAI chief would have boycotted that event. You know, the PFAI, the Players' Union, are in the same building. But, you know, if you speak to them... You know, if you got tasered, you wouldn't have been shocked. Do you know what I mean? So it's a slightly different atmosphere now.
Let's talk about the Dundalk. You're up there again tonight for the second installment of the Unite Cup.
The Unite Cup, which is a new thing. It's a very new concept, and it's still a work in progress as a concept because the All-Ireland League idea is ongoing. Or the attempts to bring in this All-Ireland League are meeting some level of opposition. Yeah, I was up at Windsor Park on Friday. I mean, I just really liked going to a good stadium with good facilities and watching some slightly different players that you wouldn't see on a regular basis and thinking, this could be good, you know, over time. I mean, what everyone wants is the same thing. Is I think, anyway, that broadly people want things to be better. You know, people want a more sustainable or better level of football here and an idea at the top end which, like, gives better players to play against more regularly isn't really going to be a bad thing. At the top end, it would work. It's further down the food chain that the problems exist, and I understand why those problems exist, and clubs fear they would be left behind. But there comes a point where do you move beyond where you are now?
If
we can manage sports, I think people, there's a lot of fears about identity and so on, but actually, I think there is probably going to be a move across Europe over the next couple of years with club football, with the Champions League so dominant that I saw Belgium and Holland have spoken about some kind of merger for their league, and maybe it needs a couple of other leagues to merge for people in Northern Ireland to maybe realise that we're not trying to take you over here, that this is something that can happen quite naturally, but you're independent, like your independence be retained in terms of your national side. I do think that there's a lot of talk about the fears, but I think that really is a main one that lies beneath it with a lot of people. But I mean, the Dundalk Linfield tonight. I mean, Oriel Park is not a great venue, and it's a hell of a security operation tonight just to make sure everything goes okay. The Linfield fans can't travel by car; they have to travel by bus. They've been told to arrive in convoy. They feel like they've been herded like animals in and out of the place, and they're not happy. So it does shine a light on some problems that do exist.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're not enough. They're not big enough problems to not embrace the wider debate.
It's called the Unite the Union Champions Cup.
Catch the United. See, people. I've said this to a couple of people. Like, what the hell is going on here?
But it's Unite
the trade union, right? But if they called it the Unite Cup, then that would have caused some problems in Belfast. Definitely, you know, like Unite. So they had to obviously go for the full title to make it a bit more acceptable. But then you're trying to unite the union. What are you trying to do here?
Oh, that union. That's
So maybe it would be easier if it was sponsored by Aldi or something, you know. But it has caused a bit of confusion, all right. But it was decent enough. I was up there anyway. Like, David Healy was there. He's the manager of Linfield. So they've had a lot going on with Michael O'Neill and all those events in the last week. So maybe didn't get the same focus and might have up north because they were going through their their managerial crisis that we would find familiar.
So that's a 1-1 draw from the first leg.
Yeah, the second leg is tonight. Yeah, so it's decided this evening. The second leg is on RTE, so it'll be a bit more visible.
This day next week, you said the Denmark game happens. Whatever happens, well, is there whatever happens? Are we guaranteed a playoff?
Yeah,
we are, even
it hasn't been officially set in stone, but yes.
If it's another 5-1,
it's irrelevant. Our playoff fate is predetermined by our Nations League results. Ireland could have come fifth in this group, and it wouldn't matter. They still have a playoff.
A bunch of other teams had to fail or succeed.
Yeah, you needed a pretty improbable series of results. Like, you needed sort of a series of results that would make Leicester's league win in 2016 look routine.
But what we can do is improve whether or not our seeding for the
no
so it's set in stone who we're playing even.
It's set in stone now. Yeah, we are. Ireland will if Ireland fail to beat Denmark next Monday. We go into a series in March where we know that our first game will be away against, and I think the three options are Bosnia, Wales, Slovakia.
Ah, okay.
And then there's various permutations between those teams, and whether they qualify or not automatically, that will determine who Ireland play. And Northern Ireland are potential opponents
in a final,
but not in a semi-final.
Okay, yeah. Okay. And so that's a one-off fixture.
One-off game, yeah.
Away from home, guaranteed for the semis.
And then there's a draw in December. I mean,
tend not to win that game, do we?
If it's possible that Ireland could be away potentially for both games. So you could have a game on a semi-final, say on a Saturday,
yeah.
And you're away in Bosnia and... you win that match emotionally, penalty shootout. It's like, where do we go now? And like 3 days later, you're going to Windsor or Cardiff or somewhere, the winner of the other semi final. So it has the potential to be pretty chaotic. So the simple solution is, I was talking about this to people on Saturday, just win the game next Monday, because then you don't have to have this debate again.
That would be good. 6 months of planning for Euros and 2 games at home. That's exactly what we should be doing. Just win that game. We've plenty of time to preview that. Now, we've got Alan Quinlan coming up in about 10 minutes or so. Sports news up next. Cliona O'Connor and David Snaith joined Joe on the Sunday paper review yesterday. David Walsh from Team Sky came up. Have a look.
Dave Walsh says Shane Sutton, he's the former head coach of Team Sky, one-time performance director of British Cycling, could not have been much amused at the discussion that took place at the tribunal in Manchester 2 days ago. According to Mary O'Rourke, the QC for Dr. Richard Freeman, in the Fit Practice case, the reason her client ordered 30 sachets of Testo gel in 2011 was to treat Sutton's erectile dysfunction. Walsh writes, forget for a moment that testosterone is not something any reputable physician would prescribe for erectile dysfunction, and consider the conversation from Sutton's point of view. He wasn't present when people were publicly discussing his sexual capabilities. He later denied that he suffers from erectile dysfunction. As for the testosterone delivery to the headquarters of British Cycling and Team Sky, he says he didn't even know it was ordered. Whereas Dr. Freeman is saying that Sutton bullied him into ordering the testosterone to help with his erectile dysfunction. What in the name of God is going on here with this lot? Like, this is now...
Yeah.
I just can't even believe that this has been... So there's a QC involved here, there's Dr. Richard Freeman, and it is their understanding that Shane Sutton bullied them to order testosterone for his erectile dysfunction. They've said this at a tribunal, and Shane Sutton says, well, one, not to get into the man's privacy too much, I don't suffer from that condition.
Just on the record.
Yeah, just want to put that out there. A bit like Pele when he was doing the ads for erectile. Now, if I did suffer from it. But two, that this is not true, according to Shane Sutton. And Walsh outlines the various other bigger questions and says, we're going to have to get to the bottom of this because it's just a bit ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole thing is in complete disrepute.
I would, was the exact Pele quote I think that Joe was looking for there. Anne-Marie, good morning to you. How are you doing?
Morning, Ger. How are things?
Where are we starting?
Well, obviously, Liverpool's lead at the top of the Premier League. 8 points after 12 games dominates headlines everywhere. Goals from Fabinho, Mo Salah and Sadio Mane yesterday, as you were discussing, saw them beat City 3-1. VAR, though, once again, one of the main talking points to come out of the game. That's after the potential Bernardo Silva and Trent Alexander handballs in the lead-up to Fabinho's opening goal. The inconsistencies of the system frustrating an awful lot of people watching on. Pep Guardiola, obviously animated on the line and at full time, but he wouldn't be drawn into a debate when asked about it after the game.
Ask to Mike Riley and the guys are in the VAR and the other one, don't ask to me. So we try to do our job. I would like to talk about our performance. It was so good.
It wasn't that good.
So no.
Apparently this is a Pep trope. After the team gets hammered, beaten, beaten up. He's like, oh, we're amazing. We were amazing.
It was a classic, like, this is the message I will be presenting today, and you can accept it, whether you like it or not.
Keep asking me questions, but I'm going to just do that.
This is the party line today.
100%, yeah. Also a special day on Merseyside for Meath man Sean Cox, as you heard as well. His wife Martina and the family returning to the ground for the first time since the unprovoked attack that left him with life-altering injuries at in April of last year. Liverpool manager Jurgen Klopp said it was a special day for him and the family.
It was very nice, and he's obviously he was very happy to see me, and I thought I'm much more happy to see him, but I think we had a draw. So it was really, really nice. His wife, his son were there as well. So it was a wonderful day for them. That's exactly what we wanted. And I can say already, whenever he wants to come, he can move to Liverpool, and then he gets a season ticket 100%, because really it was for all the boys really important news when we heard that he's able to go to the stadium and watch a football game. I saw him today, and yes, he could enjoy the game.
And Manchester United up to seventh now after their 3-1 win over Brighton at Old Trafford. Also yesterday, Aaron Connolly is to have that scan on a groin injury, which will confirm his availability for the Republic of Ireland's friendly against New Zealand on Thursday and then the Denmark game next Monday. So a nervous wait there for Mick McCarthy. Also, speaking of McCarthy, he's confirmed that Shamrock Rovers midfielder Jack Byrne is to see some game time in the New Zealand game, while Celtic defender Leo Connor, who's suspended for the under-21's trip to Armenia, is set to make his senior debut. Elsewhere then, in the Premier League yesterday, Wolves beat Aston Villa 2-1. Ruben Neves and Raul Jimenez finding the back of the net there. Absolutely loads of GAA action yesterday. It's obviously club time in the calendar. Shocknil of Derry are the Ulster Club hurling champions. That's after a 115-10 points win over Antrim's Dunloy. That's their third title in 4 years. They also won the Ulster Camogie title over the weekend, beating Loch Giel, also of Antrim. So that's another double for them. St Thomas's retained the Galway County hurling final, beating Liam Mellows 113-14 points. Fintan Burke tore his cruciate in the All-Ireland loss to Ballyhale on St Patrick's Day, and he managed to return yesterday, scoring twice in the second half. So that's a remarkable comeback there, less than 6 months. Tipperary's Barsley then saw Glen Rovers of Cork to book their place in the Munster Club Hurling Championship final. That's the first time in 33 years. They'll face Waterford's Ballygunner there, who beat Limerick's Patrick Well. And then switching codes, East Kerry won the county final in the Kingdom. That was the first time in 20 years. They saw off Dr. Crokes on a scoreline there, 214-17. David Clifford scoring 1-3 that ended Croke's four-in-a-row challenge. And All-Ireland champions Ciara Finn of Galway held off a late comeback by Ballintubber of Mayo, 110-11 points there, the final score. And they'll face Roscommon's Padraic Pearces in the Connacht Championship final. Finally for now, just really quickly, today's racing at Fairy House has had to be called off. That's due to a waterlogged course. And the headline, obviously, to come out of Navan yesterday, Gordon Elliott's 1-4 favourite Apple Jade being bet by the Willie Mullins trained Bacardis. That was in the Liz Mullen hurdle as she went for the Grade 2 contest for a third time but was beaten.
Good stuff, Anne-Marie. Thanks very much for that. Now, our documentary Grassroots to Green Shirts followed Connacht through all of last year is live now on our YouTube channel. Here's a little taste of the action.
They came to Dublin and played Leinster off the park.
Ball in hand here for Connacht, and the potential on the outside for Kelleher. Kelleher for the line. And in goal, Connacht, just 5 minutes on the watch. And angles here, Blade to Carty, and he tries to chip one through. Oh, that's brilliant from the fly-off, and he's got in beside the post. Absolutely sensational from Jack Carty. And
see, Carty, a player that we've all known, but and knew had huge potential and could shine in certain games, but to see him perform that well against such a strong Leinster team was just so unbelievably impressive.
He's got the pass inside, and Connacht heads straight back. What a game Keelan Blade is having.
I think we were the better team for 65 minutes and just let it slip. It was a devastating way to end it.
Range. Can he barrel over? Porter still going. Try! Leinster win it right at the death.
But I think for all that it was heartbreaking for Connacht, it still infused them with huge belief that they could go toe-to-toe with a team as strong as Leinster, away from home at a venue that they haven't won in a very, very long time. And not only compete, but play their own game and create things and, you know, wow the local crowd, you know, they turned it into a positive experience even though it wasn't a positive night.
Yeah, you can get that whole documentary available on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/offtheball. It's well worth subscribing to that because anytime we go live, we'll let you know and we'll give you some notifications as well. And Quillen, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Very good, thanks.
Last weekend was actually quite a big weekend in rugby because next weekend is the start of the Heineken Cup. It's we should be thankful for small mercies in Irish rugby that the big games are coming next weekend and we can forget about the World Cup for
that's the thing for the Irish provinces is and the Irish players is to try and get back, and Europe does ignite the fires a little bit, and Europe has always been big for the Irish provinces with given the history and the competition, and the Interpros, we've debated them over the last number of years, have they lost a little bit of the edge, the bit of nastiness, the bit of kind of ruthless kind of feeling to them, and I think they have, you know, but so we had the Interpros at the weekend kind of under the radar a little bit, I suppose. People are rugbyed out with the World Cup a little bit and they have to revamp a little bit. Premier League took over at the weekend and club hurling and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, look, let's start with the game in Thomond then, because Conway should have played a lot more in the World Cup, right?
Yeah, his try was superb. I think it was you know, it was a game changer for obvious reasons. It put him ahead.
It did win the game, essentially.
Yeah,
it won the game,
and it was a piece of brilliance. And it was an inside pass from Tyler Blaindell, and the acceleration, the pace from Conway, and he looks in great shape, and the speed, and the ability to get that try out of, I wouldn't say out of nothing, because it was a great inside line he ran and a good pass from Tyler Blaindell, but he had a lot to do when he got the ball, and the acceleration was phenomenal. And yeah, you go back to the arguments of he should have probably had more contribution at the World Cup. His form has been brilliant, and you know he's capable of doing that kind of stuff off broken field play. He shows up a lot as a winger on those inside lines, and he's full of work and brilliant finish from him.
Munster have a bit of an injury crisis. JJ Hanrahan did his hamstring. Tyler Blaindell came on from quite early. Tyler Blaindell has not played a lot of rugby for Munster, but when he has played, he's been good.
Yeah, I think he's a very, very talented player. I think the chopping and changing over the last number of years hasn't helped JJ, Tyler, themselves, you know, and Waneed Keatley was there. Between those three, it was a change every week. And I think JJ Hanrahan probably hadn't started two games for Munster, which is unbelievable, in a row for a long time, a very, very long time. So he played well against Cardiff, the Blues, last week, and he was starting this game against Ulster, and he's probably perceived to be ahead for Europe, that he was going to be the starting fly half, but unfortunately he picked up a hamstring injury after 30 minutes, and they're down to the bare bones now with Tyler Blaindell. He's a very good player, but sometimes you think it's the confidence and it's that authority that you need. I think a couple of years ago when he came in first, when he came back from the initial injury, he's had a lot of injuries, and I think it does affect the physical nature of the player, because I think he's a very, very good footballer, but sometimes in he looks a little bit I suppose soft in the contact areas, and he forces decisions then. It's probably a confidence thing as well, you know, but I think he's a brilliant player. I like him as a player.
He just needs a bit of time to get that confidence back, and this might be the run in the team that he needs.
Europe doesn't kind of afford you that time, you know what I mean? Even though you could argue that
I meant playing minutes as opposed to time on the ball, but yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
It's for any player to be confident and battle-hardened, you need a run of games, and they're now in a situation where he doesn't have a run of games again. But so he's got to rely on the talent that he has and get up to speed pretty quickly. Even though they're away in Europe, and Europe is always, it's different. The Ospreys were beaten by the Kings at the weekend, which was kind of throws them into a bit of turmoil. They have a lot of injuries themselves. Welsh players away at the World Cup. I've heard rumours that the Welsh players are not going to be back for a number of weeks. Well, if that's the case, they're just not competing in Europe if they're not going to be back. So
they won't be available this weekend?
Yeah, I don't know. I heard that last week and I tried to get it clarified. Nobody seems to know. So you can imagine if the Welsh internationals are not playing for Ospreys on Saturday, it kind of devalues the competition a bit, doesn't it? And
because
they've struggled. Yeah, because
for recovery reasons, or?
Yeah, it's a recovery scenario with the Welsh players. But look, I could be wrong on that. But if they don't play on Saturday, it makes Munster's job probably not as daunting.
Yeah.
They'll be very, very wary of underestimating travelling away in Europe, because the competition has shown over the years that no matter who you play, it can all change very quickly in Europe. But they're down to the bare bones themselves, the Ospreys. But so it's not the most daunting task for him. But it's a worry and it's a concern, because who's the backup out half? And, you know, Ben Healy.
He's the young kid, under
20s. Yeah, the under 20s. Jake Flannery.
Ben Healy looks like he's potentially great.
Very good player, and so is Jake Flannery. Two superb players. They're two fly halves. One of them played 10 at the World Cup and in the Six Nations, and Jake Flannery played 15. They swapped around a little bit, but two very, very good players. So Johan van Gran was asked, will he bring in someone? I think he'd love to bring probably someone in a short-term scenario, but it'll be interesting to see how that goes. But Dave Kilcoyne, who was showed and probably could have started a couple of games at the World Cup as well, his form was very good. He got injured last week, so he's another injury concern. But the fly half one is the one that is most worrying for them.
Is it time to stick one of the kids in? Like, isn't this what we would...
Yeah, I think unless you can find someone who's very, very experienced and very, very good player. And, you know, Munster brought in Albie Matheson last year when Conor Murray
really
was injured.
Yeah.
And he's an international. He's a former New Zealand All Black. A lot of experience, a lot of quality. If you bring in someone who's just filling a gap... I think, yeah, promote one of the younger players, unless somebody's available out of Japan or someone like that, an overseas player who is a top quality player who's played international rugby and has a lot of experience, because Europe is a bit different, Gerard. They've wrestled the week after double headers against Saracens. So
isn't this our chance to start pushing our young players out and go, look, come on, you can do this. This is the whole point of our culture. This is why we brought you through the academy.
I know you want to bring them through the right way, though, and give them game time in the Pro 14 rather than throwing them straight into Europe. That's my only reservation. Europe is different. There's an intensity and there's a pressure there. That's different, much different, and you have to try and win. You lose a couple of games in Europe early on, you're out of the competition. It's a long season. It's seen as a very, very disappointing season then, and for the Irish provinces, the kind of minimum requirement is quarterfinals, or else it's a very, very poor season.
Yeah.
So you've got to try and win these games, and they're cup matches, so you do need a bit of experience, so you don't just throw young fellas in for the sake of it.
No, I know.
I do agree with you, though. The Pro 14 is where, like, Craig Casey, Ben Healy, Jake Flannery, these guys come through. Liam Coombs played the other night. Shane Daly's been in the group. So Munster are trying to reintroduce young players and get them through, because there's a lot of guys who were born outside the province, if you like, there. And there's two more high-profile South Africans coming in next year. But it's about management the next few weeks, and they're kind of down to the bare bones at fly half.
This existing centre partnership must be like, which one of us is going here?
Yeah, for Rory Scannell.
For Rory Scannell.
And a very consistent player for Munster over the years, and Chris Farrell.
You'd assume Farrell's going to keep his place.
Well, you would presume that, yeah, because he's a very good player and he's on the national team, and Rory Scannell is not at the moment. So, you know, things can change very quickly. But if I was the player, yeah, I'd be disappointed. I had that situation many years ago when Jim Williams was signed for Munster, and, you know, he was a 6 and 8.
Yeah.
Axel was there, Wally was there, and, you know, more competition coming into the back row. You wouldn't be that pleased about it, but... You know, I had to kind of knuckle down, and we ended up playing a lot together because invariably one of us someone was injured all the time, and I moved over to 7 a fair bit as well. So you just got to go with it. And I think Munster, they're big statements, aren't they? They're big signings, and you know, they're world class players. And I think it's been a while since they've signed world class players, so it's a big statement from them.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Ronan Kelleher. I was listening to the lads on the way in on, it was Sunday, and they were saying that Kelleher's try scoring, I think he's got 6 tries already this year, and the record for a hooker in the Pro 14 in a full season is 8. and we're at
he's six 11th, already.
Yeah, at the 11th of November here. So you would expect him to break the record over the course of the rest of the season if he continues this. Is it just that he's in the right place at the right time, or is his performance as good as it seems?
Yeah, he's on the back of a couple of mauls, to be fair, and the hooker usually scores the tries from the mauls, but his overall play around the field, he's so dynamic. I haven't seen a huge amount of him away at the World Cup. We didn't, you know, see all those games, but I've been reading the reports, and I watched the game on Friday night. Leinster were outstanding in that first half. I think they went with probably a real fear factor to the Sports Crown that, you know, this is, and it is a very tough place to go. And I think they were very, very nervous about that, but their application and their accuracy was superb. And, you know, when you see someone like Ronan Kelleher making line breaks, running switch lines, offloading, their offloading game and their attack was just immense. And he looks a superb player, a really top quality player. And obviously, when you're that young, there's still nuts and bolts that you've got to get right. Maybe the scrummaging, the line, some of the line out throwing, and things like that. You do get better at, but the ingredients are there for him to become a top quality international player.
It's the same point I'm making about Munster and the right half situation. But if we didn't have a scenario where the Six Nations was the be all and end all from a financial perspective for the IRFU, then, and you were the Ireland coach and you knew you were going to be grand for the next 4 years, you'd stick him straight in, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Or would you?
Well, someone like Ronan Kelleher now is potentially, if he starts for Leinster in Europe, or plays a part, well, he has to go straight into the Six Nations squad. You're talking about someone like Ben Healy, who hasn't, you know, he's had a small, very, very minimal involvement.
Yeah, I'm saying stick him on the bench.
Yeah, it's up to the provincial coaches to bring these guys in and play them. And if they play a number of games and then they're good enough, and they're good enough really by judging them, you can't take risks in Europe and go, well, we're just going to throw a young guy in there because we want to develop him. There is a bit of a stepping stone scenario there. Unless they're an exceptional, freakish talent out of school, like... So I think someone like Ronan Kelleher, he's played a lot of games. He's played six or seven games so far, six games for Leinster. He's been involved in all of them. He's going to be involved in the squad for Europe. So I think you need that kind of a progression. But I do agree, it'd be lovely for a scenario, but it's just not going to happen. The Six Nations is about winning, and it's a financial driver. You can do some experimenting. And where the experimenting comes in for me is that if the young guys that you want to make changes and bring in, if they're playing for the province, well,
fair enough.
You know, they're getting that game time.
And they're there on merit. It's a
little bit.
Thing.
Now, you're always taking, you might take a chance on someone. Like if Ronan Kelleher played in the Six Nations this year, for example, and even if he played very well with Leinster, people would say straight away, well, it's too early and it's a bigger step up and all that.
But we need to get that out of our culture, right?
Yeah,
we need to be like, is his form good, yes or no, on we go.
If he's involved with Leinster for Europe, well then, it's a no-brainer. Whether he starts or is second choice or third choice hooker in the squad, who knows, but he needs involvement then because the progression, the steps are positive and there's movement every time in what he's doing. But his performance was brilliant the other night. But Leinster, right across the board. Joe Tomani was really good, someone who struggled. Jimmy O'Brien, who came in for Robbie Henshaw. Robbie Henshaw withdrew before the game. Hugo Keenan at full-back. Will Connors. They're new names, aren't they? A lot of them. I know we recognise some of them from playing some Pro 14 last year and under-20s and stuff like that. But
yeah.
They're just in a scenario, Leinster, again, where they're backing these young players and this talent that are, you know, they were superb the other night.
James Lowe is Irish qualified now, or is about to be Irish qualified? Is it this month?
I'm not sure exactly when.
But he would be in our team at the minute, would he?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I think so. He's a really good player who's right across the board. He's just offers a huge amount of energy, enthusiasm and quality as well.
Yeah. Of the Irish teams heading into European action next weekend, given how good Leinster have been over the last couple of seasons, success for them is reaching semi-finals. Like the least that they'll expect is to be in the business end of the tournament.
Yeah, if you look at their group, it's Benetton, Lyon, Northampton, and I think, you know, they can win 6 out of 6 there if they get themselves right. Maybe 5 out of 6 going to Lyon. It depends what stage where they're at in the competition. Northampton, you know, they've been there before a few times with them, so they're in a good place, and it's not the hardest group. But for any of them, I think Ulster go to Bath on Saturday, and that's a big game for them, you know, because if you need away wins in Europe, and they've got Quinns, Clermont in their group as well, which are, you know, they've got to either win at Bath or Quinns. I think it's going to be very difficult to win at Clermont, so to get that away win, why not do it the first game? It gives you a brilliant opportunity to start well in the competition and build a bit of momentum. And Connacht then, who are depleted, Quinn Rue, Gavin Thornbury, both out injured. They're in a tough place with the second row. I think they were very, very, very depleted there. They've got Montpellier at home, so at least they're at home. They've had a lot of injuries, Connacht, and Andy Friend, I think, would have been, I think, shell-shocked at that first half performance last week. As good as Leinster were, Connacht were really poor in that first half.
What were Ulster like?
Munster were quite in control, I think. It wasn't the best game to watch. I think Munster were... Ulster came back into it in the second half. A lot of mistakes from Ulster, but they were very, very competitive. I think they, again, you know, a fear of what happened there 12 months ago. They were beaten 64-7. Promising. They have some good players. I think McCluskey and Marshall played well in the centre. They could have won the game. They were 16-15 up in the middle of the second half, and barred a bit of brilliance from Andrew Conway, yeah, unlocked that defence and changed the flow of it. But it was hard to judge both sides because they're still, you know, guys
trying to mesh the teams together.
Yeah, for sure. So it'll be, and that's why it's tricky for Europe, for the Irish provinces this time. Leinster were the ones who had the really, really positive performance.
Although the Ulster pack only really had Jordy Murphy coming back. Am I right, just off the top of my head?
Yeah, Jordy Murphy was probably the only one back there.
So their pack should have been...
Ian Henderson needs to come back into
fair
the
enough,
pack.
Yeah.
And Sam Carter, the Australians, a decent player. Sean Reedy, Timoney, Jack McGrath, you know, they've some good players there. And the problems for Ulster in the last number of years were probably being porous up front. So they've got to get it right there. So they were very competitive, and they frustrated Munster a lot, and there wasn't a lot in the game.
Is Jack McGrath ever going to play for Ireland again? Can he get back to that?
Yeah, I think so. I think if he plays, if he gets a run of games and performs well, and if the team go well, if they do well in Europe, it grabs the attention in the next few weeks.
Is he more a scrummager? Is that, like, would that be something that he would have been known for? So is there a way back in that way when you look at how South Africa were able to dominate a game by scrummaging well?
I think his all-round game when he was at the height of his powers and playing really well is... I don't think he would have been as dynamic in the carry as Keane Healy, but his scrummaging was rock solid. And you think back 2 years ago, he was potentially, probably should have been starting in that Lions second test or third test. He was very, very close to Makavunipola. So for one reason or another, I think he's kind of fallen down the pecking order, whether it's a fitness thing or a confidence thing or an ability to play more and be more dynamic. I think, but the change of scenery, hopefully, will do him well. He's still a top player, and hopefully he gets his form back.
Yeah. All right. Alan, good stuff. Thanks so much for popping in this morning. Sure. Alan's going to be back with us on OTBM on Friday for a full preview of the Champions Cup. And we'll obviously have 2 live games from the Heineken Cup for you next weekend as well. We're back with John Duggan, Dan McDonald, and a special guest for our Pits and Peaks for the weekend that was. First, here's another snippet from the brilliant new Connacht Rugby documentary up on our YouTube channel, Grassroots to Green Shirts. Have a look.
This week's match against Ospreys is do or die. A win puts Connacht securely into the conversation for knockout rugby and kills any hope for Ospreys.
Good through the hands, and suddenly the first break. Pete Robb. Can he get the ball? It's going to go all the way. What a start for Connacht. To Tom Farrell. Oh, and finds a little bit of a hole.
What a first half he's had. What a first start in number 10 shirt. And it's away. There's a little bit of space for Cullen. Marmion again. He's going to get his second. He's not going to be caught from there. Kieran Marmion scores Connacht's fifth.
Following on from a strong win over Ospreys, Connacht turned their attention to Sale in the Challenge Cup quarter-final.
Going over to Sale, it's a tough place. We've played there a few times. I think they're a massive, typical English team, and they're massive physicality.
Give us your prediction today, Skip.
Is it actually filming? Good solid win, mate. Win by a point.
Win's a win, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's all you need. What do you got for breakfast there, bud?
Just a solid breakfast, mate.
That's a lot of bacon there.
No, it's only a piece.
And sausages.
Where's the sausages?
Two blades.
It's not mine, mate.
One, it's great to be here in Knockout Rugby. It's where we want to be. It's where we set out at the start of the season. Let's try and compete, do the best that we can on both fronts. And when you look at the pool that we got in this Challenge Cup, we had some pretty tough teams in there: Bordeaux, Perpignan, and of course Sale. You know, I haven't played them. We've gotten to know a little bit more about them, and obviously they're doing reasonably well in the Premiership now as well. So it should make for a very interesting fixture this evening.
Right, 7 minutes past nine this morning, time for Pits and Peaks. Dan and John Duggan are here. John, good morning.
Ger, how are we doing, Dan, as well? Good?
Good.
I'm going to go Peaks first. You're first.
Peaks is the good one, right?
Yeah.
I'll go back to the PFEI Awards on Saturday, and the two main award winners were Jack Byrne and Danny Mandroyu. And to me, like, the best part about that aspect of the night was their respective stories. That this time 12 months ago, Jack Byrne was at Kilmarnock, really unhappy with life, with football. Danny Mandroyu had come back from Brighton, or was about to come back from Brighton, has spoken openly. That's Jack there with his mother Jackie in the first picture, and there's Danny Mandroyu there now. Danny Mandroyu, who spoke about coming back to Ballymun and being called a waster on the street by people who knew him, because, you know, he had failed to, you know, get a second contract with a Premier League academy, a club. So both of them were probably rock bottom 12 months ago. They were both there with their mothers on Saturday. Jack with Jackie, who was pictured there, and Danny Mandroyu with his mother Sarah, who's spoken in recent months. And both mothers have spoken about the heartbreak of their kids moving away early and the heartbreak of seeing them really struggling when it did happen. And as I said, two lads who 12 months ago weren't very happy with their lives, basically. You fast forward 12 months and they're here being celebrated. They're two very technical, very talented players, both St. Kevin's boys, graduates, so, like, both creative, almost number 10s. Jack Byrne's in the senior squad this week. Danny Mandroyu's in the 21 squad this week. And if ever, like, there is a case in point, an argument for having some kind of industry here, it's that. Because at a place in time in history, they could have been lost to the game completely. In fact, players like them have been lost to the game
loads
completely.
Of them, yeah.
They're just two of the lucky ones that had an environment to come back into that worked for them, and they were able to use it to revitalize, you know, to galvanize themselves and to get going again. So I just think that's just something to celebrate. You know, that these talents weren't lost to the match, and they actually got to, like, in their own city, in their home city, be celebrated, you know, by their international managers at their various levels, with their family around them, with friends around them. You're thinking, you know, that's the kind of stuff that should be used as advertisement. And even, you know, there's a general discussion about, should you be looking for, you know, funding? Even this is what government funding can do, maybe for academies here, for stuff like that. So best players will always go. The Jack Burns, the most talented players of the generation, will always go.
Yeah, fair
but
enough.
That there's something better here, so that, like, so many more players like them fall through the cracks and never recover in every aspect of their life, not just their football career, in every aspect of their life. So you have two lads in good form on Saturday. I thought that was a good story.
Yeah, a good party. And the Mavs were heavily involved in both stories as well.
Yeah, like, massively so. I mean, I did a piece recently with Jack and Jackie. And, I mean, everyone has a story. Every sports star has a story. They don't always speak about it or get encouraged to speak about it. But I think both these cases, you know, Jack Byrne lost his dad quite young. So there's an emotive aspect to the story. And these are people who play a massive role in the lives of these players, and all the successful ones, they, you know, sometimes they put the walls up, you never get to hear the stories, and sometimes it's the one that have had the disappointment, they let the guard down a bit and you see more into their world and how they
show how important marketing is of these players.
Oh, massively so.
This, like, Gaelic Games players, I've said this for years, Gaelic Games players, we all know on the back of a cereal packet who Bernard Brogan is or who Henry Shefflin is. And it's so important now that we know who Jack Byrne is through the works of yourselves in journalism or through actual marketing. Mm. To get them, you know, known out there, to get them into communities and to hear their story, and then for them to become role models for people in the local communities who go to Daily Mount or go to Tala Stadium every week.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I've always argued that any promotion of the game here should be player-centric and player-driven. Sometimes it's all based on managers or personalities, and it's all, like, the players are the stories. There's a lot that people will, you know, will empathise with and can relate to. And I always think, you know, that should be the centrepiece of any campaign. I would have thought just Saturday, just these two players who were broken 12 months ago and now they're not. Now they're playing international football, you know, for their country. And they will both leave. Again, that is an absolute certainty, I would think. But they will leave as sort of stronger, better, more developed characters, you would
and
say.
If they wanted to stay, they could actually have a good career here. And
yeah.
You know, like, not as good as it
at
would
a
be,
level,
obviously.
Of course. Yeah, yeah. And look, yeah. We're not ready to. And you know, most, like, 99% of the leagues in the world are exporters. So there's no shame in that. No. You know, when it comes to your, but it's that we actually have the facility to provide that opportunity for them here. You know, that they can use it to be the best they can be, and if that means they leave, then you're doing your job right, actually, to a degree. You know, but there shouldn't be a mad rush for them to leave either. You know, they've only done a year here, and I would argue, I know a lot of pressure on Jack to go now, and I can understand why that would be, but even if it's another 6 months through to next summer or something, there's no need to panic. There's a lot of time on their side, both of them.
Is it true that Spurs don't have a full-time scout in Ireland anymore? I heard that recently, that they've withdrawn significantly since...
I'm not so sure about if that's the case with Spurs, because, I mean, they have got Troy Parrott in recent times. But there is one or two clubs that's been mentioned. With Chelsea pulled back their presence, and then...
Yeah.
Off the back of Gavin Bazunu going from Man City, or going to Man City from Shamrock Rovers, I'd heard that actually one or two clubs and then suddenly
got back interested.
Like, it's always very, like, big clubs, even they move in trends and cycles. Like,
yeah.
You know, Kevin Doyle went from the League of Ireland years ago and three or four went in the year after.
Yeah.
People think they might be missing something.
I'd actually heard that Spurs, after Troy Parrott had pulled back, and so the person who secured Troy Parrott isn't as involved with Spurs anymore.
You could be right. You could be right about that. I'm not so sure.
Yeah, I'm looking after that now anyway. So.
John, your peak for the weekend, first one?
It's the Sean Cox story. Maybe people would say, well, that's the least Liverpool could do with the way they, you know, welcomed him to Anfield yesterday, but it's still a very nice touch. I think they're just a very classy club. They're very much a community club. I've been there many times. I'm not a supporter of Liverpool, but for Klopp to greet him and welcome him, for the money they raised through the Legends game, 748,000 euro, I think it was, and then for Sean to have his day yesterday with his wife Martina, who spoke to Nathan and with his son there, and then for to put it up on Twitter, I think the CEO also was referring to it. I just think it's a lovely touch, and in probably one of the biggest games in the world at the moment, Liverpool against Manchester City. Of course, they should have found the time, but it is a global game. And a lot of moving parts, a lot of things going on, and I thought it was a special touch.
Yeah, I made the point about Klopp being at the heart of that as well. Like, he did pre-match press conference talk about wanting to meet Sean Cox in the day, and then after the game, brought Van Dijk down to meet him as well.
Yeah, so I just think this is NBC. This is like, even though if you look at the Sky studio yesterday, you got Souness, you got Roy Keane, you got Jose Mourinho, you got Vincent Kompany. This is one of the biggest games in the world, and for Liverpool to go out of their way to make the time, as they should, but for one of their own, for who's just an innocent supporter there 18 months ago, it's I think it's pretty special stuff. And it also just reaffirms in my mind there's a real connection between Liverpool Football Club and Irish people, and obviously you see that every Saturday night when you're flying back from Liverpool on a Ryanair plane.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Huge weekend for Liverpool fans. Right, and my peak of the weekend is the Kerry final and David Clifford fulfilling his potential, because when somebody like Clifford comes along, from the time he's 15, he starts having highlight reel goal scoring in schools matches in Croke Park, and you're like, this guy's pretty good. And then he keeps going under 16, 17, wins the All-Irelands that he does at minor level, and catapulted straight into the senior team, and is sensational from the get-go, has an amazing goal to draw the game in Clonus last year on the end of a touchdown from our special guest this morning. Kieran Donaghy, good morning to you.
Morning, Joe.
You were also one of the big winners at the weekend, of course, because now you're going to get to play some Munster club football.
Yeah, absolutely. That was, you know, when we won the club championship back in April, we kind of said that, look, if our aim was obviously to go on and win the county championship, because we were very impressive in the club championship run. We just got on a bit of a, you know, a 4-week, it's run off in the month of April. So, you know, we just got a bit of a run and we found ourselves beating the Crokes in the final. And then you have to wait around until September, October to start county championship. And yeah, we didn't perform in the two rounds of the county championship. We had a tough one away to start out in Dingle and lost to East Kerry in Killarney by 5 points, having played poorly. We found ourselves level with 4 or 5 minutes to go, and they got a penalty and they pulled away to get another 2 points. So, you know, we were kind of disappointed. We just played 2 games and we're out. But look, we've a chance now. We've Nemo in Park Erin next Sunday. And yeah, look, normally when you lose a county championship and you play poorly in it, you have to wait a full year to kind of get retribution. But look, we've a chance to get a performance out of ourselves on Sunday.
And did the team train away on the off chance that you might have this game? Or was it like, okay, down tools, we'll wait until we get the draw and see what happens?
There was a downs tool. We definitely down tools for probably 2 weeks. And Wayne obviously knew the disappointment that was in fellas from the lack of performance that we gave. And he called us back in and he said, look, lads, you know, South Kerry are motoring well, East Kerry are motoring well. You know, we don't want the scenario to happen that one of those win the county championship and we're not ready. So the boys, we've been training hard the last 3 weeks. So we've been playing trial games here and there. So, yeah, we're looking forward to it.
Yeah, were you at the game? Did you see? I didn't see see that much of it, but some of the highlights are that David Clifford was very good, but Penny Party Clifford was great as well.
Yeah, I think David really, like, you know, he was, everything he touched, something positive came out of it. He was being double marked. He was very patient. He actually, you know, you see he's got the street smarts already. He was getting double tagged and he was getting a bit of off the ball stuff. And I was wondering why he was playing out around. He was out around the 45 running around, but it was to actually draw attention to the referee that he was getting pulled and dragged. And what he did was he kind of went close to the referee, made a bit of a burst, and his marker pulled his jersey and he got a free and he slapped it over the bar and then he jogged back into full forward again. So he's got that street smarts in him already, but his goal was magnificent. He could have had another one, but he put it on a plate for his brother, who then passed it off to Evan Cronin inside, and I think he got the second goal. But like, everything he touched was gold. And Paddy really early on in the game just drove at Crokes, and they couldn't handle his running game. He's low to the ground, he's got great balance. He's one of those guys that can run us probably faster with the ball than without. He's got that innate ability. And Liam Carney too, who was in the development squad last year, but I wrote my article in the start today, but I think he has to be kind of, you know, in the game squad next year and pushing for a starting place. He was really comfortable on the ball, tall and athletic, and he took the fight to the Crokes around the middle of the field. And they were full value for yesterday's Kerry. They were, you know, Clifford, when he got the goal in the second half, you could tell he turned around, he celebrated to the crowd. It was a real momentum play. And when he got the ball, I'd say 15 seconds before that, I'd say what was going through his head was, I'm going to get a goal here and kill off the Crokes and don't let them sniff around us.
Kieran, I'm a bit of a herder in the ditch here. And it's great that obviously you're going to take on Nemo now, and I wish you the very best and hope you win the All-Ireland. But surely should a divisional team not be, should they not change the rules and East Kerry get a chance?
I don't know. It's possibly a good shout. I don't know what the rule is. I don't know. There's not too many other counties do these divisional sides. But it's the All Ireland Club Championship, and East Kerry, you know, are full value, and they come together. But they are five or six clubs coming together. So you know, if they went down and won it, or some club team up in Dublin or Galway kind of going, well, look, you know, how are we supposed to compete with five or six clubs? So I don't know what the rest of the country would think about it if East Kerry went down and won an All Ireland club. But I know years ago there was, you know, Thomond College, Pat Spillane with them, they were winning club All Ireland.
UCD.
I believe our team, the Aston Stacks team of the 70s and 80s, that had Ger Power and John O'Keefe, Mikey Sheehy, Dinny Long, they had five or six All Stars, but they only won one club All Ireland, but they might have been beaten by that Thomond College two or three times. So that was a kind of an amalgamation of players as such. But yeah, maybe it's a good shout. But
I think Eugene McGee would have won Club All-Irelands, or certainly would have competed for county titles with UCD against Vincent's. And that was when him and Heffo started their rivalry. So, and then obviously UCD would have their pick of all the best.
70s.
All the best young Irish Gaelic football students who did come to UCD. I do want to talk to you a little bit about Clifford and his progression, because there's this thing where we've known about him for so long, and as I was saying earlier, his highlight reels are so famous, like even just TG Carr showing those schools games where he would get the ball, slalom through three or four lads and stick it in the top corner, and you would see him then kick a point with the other foot and go, hang on a second, what's going on here? For him not to have been derailed at any point up to this is fairly remarkable, and there's a chance now he'll be made captain next year. Do you just make him captain and go, that's another thing to add on, to layer on, or do you let him go and make one of the other lads captain? What's the best way to make sure that he continues to fulfil his potential?
I think the one thing East Kerry must do when they're selecting the captain is Jack Sherwood is an obvious shout. I think, you know, Ratmore is also in East Kerry, and Ratmore will be in with this East Kerry squad next year. So the likes of Paul Murphy, you know, coming into that team, possibly even Aidan O'Mahony, Shane Ryan, the goalie, coming into this East Kerry squad. So East Kerry are going to be around for a while. They're also missing Darren Wynan, who was a great player coming off the bench for Kerry this year. So they were missing him too yesterday. So look, they're going to be around for quite a while. And if they have a period of dominance, I think I go with Clifford just on the basis of you know he's a guaranteed starter. You know, I don't think it won't affect him. He's taken everything in his stride so well, like no reason to think that he wouldn't take captaincy in his stride. And look, Donegal made Michael Murphy captain of Donegal at 21, and that didn't work out too bad for them or the player in question. And you know, having been around Michael Murphy in international rule setups, and having been around David for the year, they're quite similar characters. They have an edge about them. They're obviously quality, you know, they're obviously quality players. And you know, I think he can take that in stride, and just, you know, Kerry needs somebody that they need a captain that, you know, can really be a huge influence on the game. And you know, Clifford being captain of Kerry and him scoring 1-3, it's worth more than 1-3 because the fans already love him. He's got that kind of bond with the fans already. But you know, all of a sudden, if your captain leading the line like David leads it, you know, it gets extra momentum from the crowd. It gets extra pump from the players around him. He's your go-to guy at the moment, anyway. So yeah, I think you just go with him, Ger, and you give him that honour. I don't think it's gonna, you know, I think it'll rest easy on your shoulders, if I'm being honest.
Last question for you. Should every county employ divisional sides? It seems to work very well for you guys.
Yeah, I think it's an idea. I remember talking to Eamon O'Hara about the Croke Park Hotel this year, and we were talking about it. You know, he was congratulating me in the club championship, and, you know, I was saying, yeah, but look, the county championship is coming down the line. And he was asking me about this divisional sides, that they were looking at something like that in Sligo. But absolutely, like, it's something that every county should be doing, really, because it gives every guy a chance. You know, you look at a guy like Declan O'Sullivan from Drummond Pierce's, you know, who was a Kerry great now and was a huge leader in the dressing room for 12 years. If he hadn't been playing with South Kerry and winning county championship with South Kerry, he might never have just, you know, it might have been harder for him to get through. But when he was playing with South Kerry, he was just so good. And, you know, you see him again on county final days against the Gaeltachts, against the Tomás O'Shea's or something like that, and he puts in a big performance. All of a sudden, the Kerry manager is kind of going, okay, this guy can do it. Whereas if he's doing it in intermediate championship games, you know, there's always that question mark, what's he going to be like against at the top level? But it's something definitely that county should look at for small areas, pockets of clubs to come together and try and make a run of the county championship, because there is the East Kerry rivalry and they do kill each other for lots of parts of the year. But they do look at the point then of, okay, look, you know, we're good enough, let's go win the county championship together and let's create a memory together that we'll have forever.
Yeah.
And yeah, we'll go back and kill each other next week when we're playing East Kerry championship. But that's life, that's sport. You know, you have to have that competitive edge in you that you get on with guys, but then you go to war with them a week later and everybody has to accept that.
All right, Kieran, good stuff this morning. Thanks a million for joining us.
All right, Joe, no hassle.
It's Kieran Donnelly giving us some thoughts on that. Time for a couple more quick peeks. Do you have any more peaks? Or are we on to...
No, I'm on to the pits.
Go for it.
Straight to the pits.
Go on, Tom.
No, John, go for it.
Well, Guardiola. What's he at?
I had Guardiola too. Just being a baby.
Well, it's like falling down Michael Douglas. You remember, like, he's just like completely losing the rag with a gun. And
well, I hope he doesn't go that far.
Obviously not. But just this twice stuff, this madness, like just screaming at the sky, the sarcasm he showed towards the referee, and then trying to deny it. Why don't we just go admit it that, look, you were, look, I was upset and I was just a little bit, you know, I wasn't being too genuine.
They should ban him, shouldn't they? For the thank you very much, thank you, thank you, thank you.
It'd be a great case, though, to try and make it. You'd have to bring in, like, an expert on handshakes.
or insincerity.
Yeah, you know. Like, but I know what you're saying about, like, Pep, but isn't being a really bad loser not part of being a really good manager? Like, you know, can you think of too many good managers that have been really...
No.
Really great at losing. They all manage.
Not great at losing.
No. You know, Wenger, like, the king of being the bad loser.
Cody? Is Cody good at losing? I thought Cody's always quite... Maybe on the front of the surface has always been very magnanimous.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe in terms of the front. Yeah, but you know, he's seething inside, and I'm sure there's... Yeah, I'm just saying.
Yeah, so you don't think he shouldn't be a pit this week? You're like, I don't know, forgive that.
I can understand why he annoys people, and I can understand why he's in that category this week, but I just think that that's probably part of his makeup, so he's not going to suddenly change, is it really?
That's part... But that comes back to my question about whether or not this is the beginning of the end. I don't know if he's able to sustain this level of intensity for a long period of time, and I don't know if the players are going to continue to respond to it. Because if you're watching that on the sideline, you're like, is that helpful to us? Is it really? Are we going to be more or less likely to get a penalty the next time? Because you've been like, everybody in that sideline will remember you going tow, tow, tow. And the handshake, the referee. Now maybe he doesn't get to referee a game.
He's a guy under pressure. He's a guy who is in a kind of an uncertain, an unusual position. And it's now 8 years since he won that Champions League. He didn't succeed.
With Leo Messi in his team. Leo Messi, it's a cheat code.
He didn't win at a
Barn. He's got no Leo Messi anymore.
He didn't win at a Barn.
They played great football. They changed football forever. They did, and they were absolutely sensational. Yeah. But you can make the case that he's underachieved in the Champions League.
Ask to Mike Riley, and the guys are in the VAR and the other one. Don't ask to me.
Don't ask to me.
Yeah, I mean, you can make the point. But
next one.
Pitts. Well, Pitts for me was not so much some of the chanting. I'm going back to my own patch. I'm surprised we didn't have a horse racing one between us, John.
Well, Apple's Jade is low.
But some of the sectarian chanting at Windsor Park on Friday. I mentioned that Linfield and Dock game earlier. But actually, not so much the chanting itself as regrettable and as it should be condemned, but some of the reaction to it, in that people seizing upon it and saying, well, this is evidence that we shouldn't look at some kind of cross-border relationship. Like, it was... idiotic behaviour from a minority of idiots, but if you use that as evidence to think that this can't happen, like you're almost pandering to it. You have to accept that. Like, I know that I spoke earlier about how other sports operate on an all-island basis, but what's obviously very different with football is that it's the one that would bring together people from a different demographic that don't necessarily come together in other sports. And there is a certain degree of ignorance, there's a certain degree of tension. But if you use some chance at a game as evidence that you shouldn't bring these together on a more regular basis, then you never actually cure some of this division that exists. You wouldn't play a Celtic Rangers game if you use the same logic, that some chance in the crowd are... Now, like, what happened was bad. I think there's a very strong possibility...
A lot of people have missed what happened.
From the away section, there was a few sort of IRA teams chants. I think from the home fans, there was a flag produced that would have sort of... that would inflame tensions. It was a bit of back and forth, you know. But I have to say, like, it didn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me if there was more of it tonight. But and if any part of the dock manager felt he wanted to apologise afterwards for it, and like, it wasn't great, you know. There was some singing of anthems and tunes, and like, the Fields of Athenry was sung from the away section. I mean, it's one thing Munster fans singing Fields of Athenry, that was questionable geographically, but Dundalk fans singing it, you know, these aren't regulars who would be going to games to sing this. But I'm just saying, like, when you bring together teams who don't encounter each other often with a bit of history, there's going to be a bit of that spice. And you can't get a bit, won't someone think of the children and take a real sort of God-fearing stance to the whole thing and say, well, then we can't proceed with this because this will happen. This is part of the process. Like, this will happen. Like, 40 years ago...
So dealing with it.
Linfield and the Dock couldn't play in Belfast
because
of the troubles. They had to play in Holland because, you know, there was troubles in the match. Like, it's a progress of sorts. That if the worst thing that happens is a couple of stupid chants, I mean... Over time, you have to deal with those growing pains.
Curated properly.
Yeah, yeah.
Education.
And that marginalises people over time if you have the facility and the ability to cope with it.
All right, we've 30 seconds left, John, for your last one.
Well, Apples Jade might have been just the beginning of the end for Apples Jade. Beaten by Bacardi is that horse I really don't like anymore because I never back him when he wins. but Apples Jade, yeah, has won her last two seasonal reappearances in that Lisbon hurdle. Didn't yesterday. Might be Father Time for Apples Jade, sadly, but what a great servant.
All right, good stuff. Lads, thanks for joining us today. That is it from us, 9:31. If you missed any of it, the sports pages, football and Fabinho with Kenny Cunningham, the pits and peaks on the weekend with Kieran Donaghy, rugby with Alan Quinlan. It is all available on offtheball.com/podcast or indeed the Go Loud app. You can watch it back on our YouTube channel. You can subscribe there. Tonight on Off The Ball, the football show, Monday Night Rugby and much more tomorrow morning on OTB AM. We're back from 7:30. We'll see you then. Good luck.
That was an Off The Ball Podcast Network presentation.